It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, a great panel assembled for you to really get down to the nuts and bolts on the Apple DOJ case. This is really good stuff, and we have the best. Ben Thompson from Stratechery, Ed Bott from ZDNet, and Christina Warren from Mashable. We will flatten this story next on Twit.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. Hi, everybody. It's time for our annual audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It helps us understand our audience better, know what you like and don't like, how you listen to the show. It also helps us tell advertisers what kind of people listen. But I promise you, your feedback is always kept personally anonymous. All you have to do is visit twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. It'll just take a few minutes, and it'll help us make Twit even better. We really appreciate your support and any help you can give us. twit.tv/survey. This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 550, recorded Sunday, February 21st, 2016. Apple versus the DOJ. This Week in Tech is brought to you by ShipStation.com. When you're selling online, getting your orders out the door quickly can be tough. ShipStation.com is the fast, easy way to manage and ship all your orders in one place. For a free 2-month trial, visit ShipStation.com. And before you do anything else, click the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Twit. And by Gazelle, the online marketplace for buying and selling used gadgets. Shop from a variety of certified pre-owned electronics or trade one in for cash. Give new life to a used device at gazelle.com today. And by audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get 2 free books. Go to audible.com/twit2. And don't forget to follow Audible on Twitter. User ID audible_com. And by GoToMeeting, the powerfully simple way to meet with coworkers and clients from the convenience of your computer, your smartphone, your tablet. Share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing. For a 30-day free trial, visit GoToMeeting.com today. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news with the best journalists in technology. We got them today, and we got some big, big stories to talk about. Joining me right now, Christina Warren from Mashable. Always nice to have you, Christina. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
We thought it was going to be Academy Award night. We were all set to have Film Girl talk about films. We will anyway, because I'm really curious what you think. But there are bigger fish to fry. And here, one of our chief fish fryers, Mr. Ben Thompson from Stratechery, joining us from Taipei today. Hello, Ben.
Good morning.
Good morning. Early morning. What time is it?
7 o'clock.
Oh.
Not bad.
You got a kid. You're up this early anyway.
Yeah, something like that.
I do not want to diminish your generous contribution. Thank you for being here so early. I really appreciate it.
Happy to.
And he knows what's happening on Monday, so that's important. living in the future. Also joining us, the great Ed Bott from ZDNet, my old buddy. It's great to see you, Ed.
Thank you,
again.
Leo. What a nice thing to say.
Yeah, from the great southwest of this nation.
Yes.
I put the
flag up here.
It helps me.
So that you
it helps me know you're in New Mexico, not Arizona. I can tell now. Don't know where in New Mexico, but somewhere nice.
Turn left at Albuquerque.
That sounds like an Eagles song.
I think it's actually a Bugs Bunny.
Oh, well, close.
Bugs Bunny reference.
Okay, good. I'm keeping it light right now because we're going to probably get into a fairly heavy conversation about Apple, the FBI, and what the hell is going on. And I have to say, this story, which broke on Wednesday, came in dribs and drabs. We didn't really kind of we saw the court order to Apple saying you've got to help the FBI unlock this phone. We saw Tim Cook's response. We had a very good conversation, I think, with the technical information additions from Steve Gibson on Wednesday on This Week in Google. Jeff Jarvis and Matthew Ingram and I, with Steve Gibson's help. But since then, more and more information's come out I don't probably need to summarize the story. You all know there was a cell phone that belonged to the San Bernardino County Health Department but was in use by its employee, the shooter in the San Bernardino mass shooting tragedy a few months ago. The FBI got that cell phone. They didn't get the other cell phones. Those were destroyed before the shooting. But this cell phone survived. It's an interesting position because it's owned by this by San Bernardino County Department of Health. It's not owned by the shooter. It also, he agreed to the right to monitor. So really, there shouldn't be any issue at all about unlocking the phone and looking what's on it, except that it is locked. It's an iPhone 5C, but of course, Apple was updated to iOS 9, so it was encrypted. The FBI has asked the court to force Apple to help them unlock it, not decrypt it, but unlock it. The court said Apple has to do a few things, has to make a modified firmware. And by the way, as you probably know, firmware can't be put on an iPhone and will not work on an iPhone unless Apple signs it. So they would have to sign this with their super secret signing key, put on the iPhone. Firmware would do a couple of things. One, it would disable the automatic erasure if more than 10 attempts to unlock the phone are made, in case the bad guy turned it on. And it would also reduce the delay in between key presses. There's an 80 millisecond delay between key presses to slow down brute forcing.
That's not quite right. There's a 5 second delay.
5 seconds. Okay.
The 80 milliseconds is how long it takes the phone to actually process the request.
Okay. So they can't speed that up.
Right. The minimum is 80 milliseconds, and it has to be done on the device because part of the key is a combination of the passcode and the unique UID, the unique identifier of the device, which is not known to Apple, is not tracked. It's imprinted like in the silicon, basically. And so the 80 milliseconds is the limit, which is the other thing here. I mean, no one said how long the passcode is, but because of that 80 millisecond delay, if it's anything but a, you know, 4 or 5 digit numeric passcode, it's going to be pretty impossible to brute force anyway. I presume it's just a 4-character one or 4-digit one, I should say. But that 80 milliseconds is still a pretty substantial amount of time.
This kind of underscores there's a lot we don't know about this. So the court order was that Apple should modify the firmware, turn off the delay, turn off any, you know, automatic erasure on the phone, not to actually crack the phone, but just to give the FBI an opportunity to run an automated – and to give the FBI software access to the phone so they could run an automated brute forcing attack so they could unlock it. It's kind of a weird request. In the past, Apple has, in fact, been ordered to decrypt criminals' iPhones and deliver the information to law enforcement, and they say they've done that. In fact, they've done it, I think, 70 times. They don't like doing it, and that's one of the reasons they released iOS 8, which had full disk encryption.
Right. Apple can't decrypt it. I think that's the big thing here. Right. That's what makes this. There's multi-levels to the story, and I certainly feel your pain about it dribbling out. I mean, I had a very widely spread. I made a daily update free on Thursday that ended up having a couple things wrong. But I mean, it is what it is. Which there's an update to it. The way encryption works, and Apple uses very strong encryption on the disk, is that even if you have the data on the disk, if you don't have the key, like, you're not getting it. You're just not. It's theoretically possible, but realistically impossible, even with a brute force attack. So the issue is, if the FBI really cared about this, like, they could, like, extract the data off of the memory chips and, like, then try to brute force it. But the whole issue is that it's easier, even with all these challenges. The only realistic way is to break the passcode itself, which again has to be done on the device because it's tangled with the device ID. Because no one can break encryption, and I think that's what makes this a such a multi-layered issue. Is I think the real fear in the very long run for any of us in tech is the is the idea that Apple would want to have to make some sort of golden key or skeleton key for their encryption itself, which is a really terrible idea.
And Apple says they can't do it, right? They could going forward.
You can't do it after the fact, exactly. Which is why I think the real concern here is that the FBI loses this case and then leverages that into congressional action to force this sort of gold key thing. Say, we can't trust Apple. Apple's not going to help us, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, all those times that Apple helped the FBI were pre-iOS, were as far as I know, pre-iOS 8.
Yes, they were. And that was before the encryption stuff. Right. So it was a different sort of assistance and a lot of times from what I understand, they were just instructing them to look towards tools that already existed from third parties and not actually, you know, giving them any data themselves.
Although as Jonathan Zdarsky, who's a really great Apple expert, pointed out in a long blog post, there's a difference between what Apple used to do, which is essentially do what they needed to and provide the contents of that phone to law enforcement, versus creating a forensics tool, which is what the court is ordering them to do now. And there is a much higher burden of proof with a forensics tool than there would be when just Apple saying, well, here's what was on the phone. So this is a fairly burdensome, as it turns out, fairly burdensome order from the court. Apple has said it won't do it, and it will appeal. They have some extra time. It looks like they're going to be given 3 extra days to respond.
Yeah, they have until Friday.
February 26th now. And I don't know what Apple will say. We only know that as soon as this order came out, Tim Cook wrote this open letter and posted it on the Apple website saying, you know, this is why it's a bad idea. We think this needs to be public. Now, there's some additional information that may change the color of this. A couple of things. First of all, apparently Apple had originally asked the FBI to do this under seal, privately. And the FBI declined. They decided to do it publicly.
Right.
The reason that might be interesting is maybe Apple was willing to comply but just didn't want anybody to know they could comply. Or I don't know what. I'm not sure why.
I don't think that's true, because in the narratives that we've had so far, it's been very clear that they had tried the 4 different techniques that Apple recommended, and none of them worked. And so they were at the impasse of saying, then our only option left is for you to give us physical assistance to getting into the contents here, where we can then try to decrypt it. So that's, they've already said that the cooperation ended unsuccessfully. And so now we're at the FBI asked them to do a specific thing. They said no. And so we go to court. Now, one fascinating thing that seems to have happened here, though, that is different from other similar situations in the past, is previously something like this starts out and the facts come out first. So I remember when Apple's phone was liberated from that bar. It was an iPhone 4, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes. All those facts came out first, and then it turned into a court case, and then the lawyers got involved. With this, the very first salvo is from the lawyers from the Department of Justice, and the response, and Tim Cook might have signed that letter, but it was written by lawyers, or at least, you know, vetted and sealed by lawyers. And as a result, every bit of information that we've had on this story so far has come in legal form, which means that every word is carefully chosen to communicate a particular fact so that it might be true, but they might want us to believe something else.
There is some other information that didn't come vetted or in legal form, and it throws further mud in the water. Initially, the FBI, Apple pointed out that the iCloud password had been changed while the phone was in the FBI's custody. The FBI immediately threw the San Bernardino County Department of Health under the bus, saying they did it.
Then threw the and then they immediately threw the FBI under the bus.
They tweeted, "No, the FBI told us to do that."
Although in my mind, they're both sort of incompetent, because from best I can tell, and I've been working on a story about this for the last few days, there was absolutely no mobile device management software on the iPhone that was given out by the San Bernardino Department of Health.
Apple pointed out, well, that's dumb. Apple pointed out, though, had they not changed the iCloud password, it's very likely that as soon as they went to a known Wi-Fi access point, such as his home or work, the phone would have gone, oh, let me back up over Wi-Fi, and then they would have had access to that backed up data. So,
right. I mean, we don't really know if that would have been the case or not, because we don't know if there was another problem on the phone there, if that setting had been enabled or disabled. But at the very least, they could have attempted it. And
well, let me give you a let me give you my conspiracy theory.
Sure.
I think the FBI wants this case. We know that James Comey, the director of the FBI, is one of the strongest advocates in government. And by the way, there is no unified point of view in government about encryption, end-to-end encryption. In fact, I've been told the NSA wants end-to-end encryption and believes it's important to national security. But the FBI does not. They are worried about bad guys going dark. That's the term they use. And Comey has been looking for a case to set a precedent. And what better case than a terrorist and his phone belonging to a terrorist? And so I think they were looking for exactly this kind of case. And if it were easy to get the information, they wouldn't have been able to go for the precedent. So my conspiracy theory, which kind of impugns the FBI here, is that they didn't want to easily decrypt this device. They wanted this device to be hard to decrypt. Why else would you why would you change the iCloud password? Is that a ham-fisted attempt to get the data?
No, there is.
They know better than that. They know better than that. I know that.
You know that. I mean, I think that this might have been a case where they were so desperately trying to get access to something and just made a sloppy mistake. I would hope that was the case.
That's all, you know what? I don't buy it. I think the FBI's forensics is much better than that. They know what they're doing.
There's actually an explanation for this.
Oh, okay.
They changed the iCloud password so that they could access the backups. And then they discovered that the backups
they
had stopped on October 19th or 20th.
Right.
And that's when they said, oh, there's crap. Additional information on the phone. And the so backups.
That's still ham-fisted. They could tell how the last backup without being able to unlock it, right? Maybe not. Maybe you couldn't get into the computer.
They had to get into iCloud to see the backups.
Oh, I see. All right.
And then they would have said, oh, well.
Okay.
So, I think this is probably a case where they didn't want to wait for Apple to respond. They wanted to get information as quickly as possible and went too fast. And by doing that, ended up, you know, kind of screwing themselves. But all of this, of course, is on the predisposition that the precipition that there is something on this phone that can be useful in this case. And personally don't know.
There's not a lot to indicate that there is. They destroyed their two personal phones.
Well, that's I was going to say the two personal phones are destroyed. Find My iPhone was enabled. So for Find My iPhone to be enabled, but backups to be disabled, Jonathan Zdarsky was pointing out that seems weird too. There are a lot of questions about this that make me think there might not be anything on this phone, but that doesn't change the fact that as your greater point, this is a very important case for the FBI, and this is the perfect case that you can try in public to try to get issues of encryption legislated.
So I think it's important to, there's really three layers, you know, arguably more, but I would characterize there being three layers to this case. And I think it's important to keep those layers distinct, because otherwise it's very difficult to keep track of what's going on. So layer one is what is not going on in this case. And that is encryption. This case is not about encryption. And actually, I saw a headline in the Wall Street Journal, the Apple FBI encryption case. It has nothing to do with encryption. No one is asking Apple to break their encryption. There is not to date a discussion of this golden key, which I just brought up recently. I think, but it's something that looms over this case, because that is something the FBI has wanted previously. It was put to rest, at least temporarily, last year, in a bit of a repeat of kind of the crypto wars of 20 years ago. And there's been reports have come out that the FBI has kind of basically said, well, okay, we lost this round, but let's keep our eyes open for a chance to reopen it, which this certainly would seem to fit the bill. So that's one, is what is not happening. There's not a debate about encryption going on right now. What is going on is a debate about security broadly, and security of iPhones, and whether or not Apple can be compelled to weaken their security measures. Again, they can't break the encryption. It's not possible. But they can be compelled to do the things that you listed. And the question is that covered under the All Writs Act? And as an aside, I'm a little tired of this act from 1789. I mean, that's the act that established
the All-Writs Act, which is
not the All-Writs Act. It's not the All-Writs Act.
Oh, it's not.
It's part of the Judicial Act, which established the court system, which I don't think anyone is calling to undo because the law happened to be passed in 1789. I mean, the All-Writs Act is not an unreasonable thing. And it's
why do people cite the All-Writs Act as being...
Well, what he's saying is that he's... I think what you're saying, Ben, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't want to speak for you, is that you're tired of people saying, why is this law from 1789 defining what's happening now, when in actuality, that's sort of what the law was created for, which is
a
for
general, like this. A very general situation. Where
it's been cited in a lot of similar cases over the years. It's been used in phone unlocking cases since 2005. It was used as the basis for other sorts of cases. I think that's probably a good point. I still think that they're using this as a way to get around the fact that there's not legislation.
I'd be happy to get to as my third point. I mean, the All-Writs Act was a part of the Judicial Act of 1789. Just my only point.
No one's saying
that we should undo the Supreme Court because the law came from 1789. Like, it's part of the same set of laws that passed at the same time, a la the Bill of Rights. The third point, which Christina just referred to, is the political angle, and which is what kind of ties the first two together. And that's where a lot of the new developments are from, is an attempt to win the political war. It doesn't really matter at the end of the day how or why, from a legal perspective, it doesn't really matter how or why the iCloud password got changed. It matters from Apple trying to win the PR war, where frankly they're at a disadvantage. I mean, because we're dealing with a terrorist attack that happened, and the FBI, I think, I don't think there's any question whether or not they did this on purpose. I don't think there's any question that they see this as an opportunity to win a political battle. And I think these are clearly all tied together, but they all have distinct issues, and that's why it's easy to get these mixed up together. It's not about encryption specifically, but that's certainly in the background. It is about this compelling software company to create software, not to simply take advantage of software they already have. Pre-iOS 8, Apple simply needed to use their root certificate, and they could extract data off the device because it wasn't encrypted. And they could extract the data off this device as well. The only problem is it would be encrypted.
Right.
And then part three is big picture. What's going on politically? What is the attempt in the long run to compel this? And again, and I think that's what's going on, especially over the weekend with this stuff. This is Apple fighting back. I mean, Apple was, I think, justifiably and understandably pissed off at the FBI's court request, which framed this as a marketing stunt by Apple.
The FBI literally said this is good. This is Apple going full bore marketing wise.
Right. We can certainly get into, but
it is good. I mean, they're not wrong. It's good for Apple to promote their privacy. In fact, it was somewhat of a revelation to me that this was that Apple could even do this, that they could sign a modified firmware that would make it easier to get into an iPhone. I mean, you say it's not about decryption, but once the phone is unlocked, the data is decrypted. It is a methodology to decrypt the phone.
It's not about forcing Apple to break their encryption, though.
No, they don't have to break their encryption. They merely need to break into the phone. But the end result is the same.
No, but it matters. The reason it matters is because, one, they can't break their encryption. That's the entire point of encryption.
Mm-hmm.
Two, the FBI would like Apple to create encryption with a golden key,
That's not this.
No, but that's part of the
backdrop. This might be a slippery slope, yeah.
Well, it's not just a slippery slope. You can see a scenario where Apple wins this case, as they very well may, because part of the All-Writs Act, as later defined by the Supreme Court, which again was created at the same time, was that there can't be an unreasonable burden. And
there's quite a burden to this if Jonathan Zdarsky is correct. This is a significant effort to do this.
Well, I mean,
Apple's not a forensics company. They'd be required to create a forensics tool,
right? And so Apple could very well win this case on its merits from a legal perspective. But then that's where you kind of come big circle. Like, you can see the FBI going to Congress and saying, "Look, we had a terrorist attack on U.S. soil. Apple refused to help, and legally they were not compelled to. We need legislation that won't allow this to happen again." The best way to get this legislation is to make it so we don't even have to go to Apple in the future.
Right.
We have a golden key that lets us get this stuff. And again, this is by far the worst possible outcome. I mean, the big difference with that is then you have a silent failure of security because no one will know when or if that is compromised. Right. And it will be eventually. So that's what makes this so complicated is there's multiple levels going on. And one of the levels is, and it is a PR thing. And it's a PR thing because ultimately the end game is potentially congressional action that could result in something even worse than what's Apple being compelled to do here. And so there's multiple levels of thinking about this that are going on and makes it, which is why it's not going to be a story that's going to go away, and nor should it.
We had yesterday on the new screensavers, we had Julian Sanchez. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, but he was one of the authors of the Berkman study, Don't Panic, which was an excellent study. And some of the best security researchers in the world were brought in on this panel. The conclusion there was don't worry. There's no reason for the law enforcement to worry. There are more ways to surveil us than ever before. And they will, and I've already said, we'll use all of them. But what Julian said is that absolutely that's going to be the upshot of this case is a resurgence of legislation to provide backdoors. That's what this is all about. He agreed.
Which is a far worse outcome. And that's why, I mean, I absolutely support Apple's position. One, two, I agree there is a very serious problem with precedent here. But three, I'm also very wary of how this is going to play politically. And I've gotten some pushback from members about this because principle is principle. Like, yes, principle is principle, but there's multiple layers of principle. And make no mistake, a golden key is the worst possible outcome if you care about security.
Yeah. But we should be clear that that is not what's being asked for at this time.
It's not. It would be impossible because, as you noted, I mean, that's a forward. That's a forward-looking security measure, right, which gets at why it's so terrible, as opposed to something that is backwards, that is, you know, retroactive, which is the case here. I mean, the more I've been kind of making this point for the last couple of days, the more I think about it, I think I do think that Apple is right to fight and win this and win on the merits. And I think there was a great tweet the other day that something about the U.S. messing with the three great world religions, and I can't remember what the other two were, but the third one was Apple. And I think the FBI is probably going to get more of a fight than they bargained for on this, which is great. I mean, we've all, you know, good on Apple for leveraging that.
Very clear is that there is an agreement in the federal government, whether in the administration, law enforcement, or Congress. I don't believe there is a consensus on providing a backdoor. I think there were many members of Congress stepped forward and said Apple was doing the right thing. Some said Apple should absolutely comply. I don't think there, and I've heard from others inside the Beltway that there is no consensus on how to handle encryption.
I think that's the one. I mean, you mentioned the NSA, and I think the issue here is the FBI. I mean, and James Comey has been particularly incalcitrant on this on this point.
We know who wants a backdoor most. That's James Comey, director of the FBI.
Well, and I think the thing to remember is the FBI is mostly dealing with, yes, they deal with domestic terrorism, but by and large, they're dealing with probably mostly less sophisticated criminals. There's a lot of drug cases that come up. There was an interesting story about, you know, there's this thing in the Patriots Act, like a peak provision that lets you invest or basically spy on someone without them knowing you are if you got a court order. And it was said at the time, this is for terrorism. It's not going to be used for anything else. And since then, 95% of cases have been about drugs and like 0.5% have been about terrorism, which I think the FBI just wants this capability. And they don't. The problem is you look at a big picture. When it comes to encryption, we have more to lose by not having our stuff encrypted. By we, I meaning the United States. I mean,
That's what the NSA says.
Secrets, right, whether it comes to corporate secrets, whether it comes to things our government. And the other thing is, I mean, the United States has the most capability of overcoming and avoiding that. I mean, we're the ones that have all the satellites. We're the ones that are listening in on communications all over the world. And so if you game this out, when it comes to a systematic look at our capabilities versus Chinese capabilities versus the very anyone else's capabilities, it behooves the United States to have stronger encryption because the United States has more ways around that encryption relative to other countries. So it makes the playing field more uneven. So, yes, from a big picture perspective, encryption is good. And fortunately, that has convinced enough people in D.C. Unfortunately, the FBI has its head up its rear end a bit and only cares about their particular problems. And you know, gets us, you know, now we're stuck in this morass.
Another point to be made is that no matter what happens with Apple, strong encryption is widely available from sources all over the world. I think it was more than 70 countries make encryption software available. The math is out there, and there's nothing anybody really can do in the long run to prevent encryption from being used. So the notion of putting a backdoor into software made in the United States, all that does is weaken the product from the United States.
This is getting, but that is getting, I understand how you can game things out so that it gets to that point, but it was going to get to that point anyway.
That we argument,
those bills are being written. Those lobbyists are working on this already. If you're looking for a test case on encryption, this isn't the one.
Right.
This because as Ben rightly notes, it has nothing to do with encryption. What it does have to do is setting the precedent that large, very, very, very large and influential American tech companies can be required to cooperate and provide technical assistance to the United States government when a proper warrant is issued. Now, one thing that I do
isn't
like
isn't that
about
the case, and
case,
shouldn't that be the case? I mean, why should they be exempt?
I think it should be the case. And one thing that I'm really happy about in this case is that it's not coming through the secret FISA courts.
Right.
That this entire thing is being argued very, very publicly with good legal teams on either side. So the arguments will be, you know, Ted Olson is working for Apple. You don't get any better in terms of arguing before the Supreme Court than Ted Olson.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good thing to note that there is such clarity around this. I mean, there's zero question about the government's right to the data, frankly.
I think one reason this case was handpicked because the government owns the phone.
Well, not just that, but I mean, if ever there was a justifiable warrant, I mean,
right.
this was one of them.
You know, a known terror. The guy committed a horrific crime.
Right. I mean, the legal issues are
so
very
clear. So to be very clear, and a lot of people, including Donald Trump, said, well, you should boycott Apple because they're un-American. This is not about Apple protecting a terrorist. That's not at all what this is about.
Yeah, well, you know, Donald Trump, come on. He's no Ted Olson.
When he's president of the United States, you're going to change your tune, buddy boy. That's all I can say.
The other thing to remember is I think if you go back to the cyber war, you know, the cyber wars of the 1990s, and this was when encryption was a, you know, the first time that encryption was really challenged. And this go dark debate is not a new debate.
Oh, no.
In that case, the U.S. government for a time actually limited the export of encryption. So I think the most famous example was Netscape. The international version had 40-bit encryption.
And
which
look at the consequence of that, by the way, because that bad encryption still plagues us today with signing keys for SSL. There are escalation attacks that you could trick a browser using weak encryption because that encryption's in there because of those export restrictions from years ago.
Right, because the U.S. one was allowed to have 128, but it was too complicated to verify you were
right,
like
so you
in
just
the
make
U.S.
It 40
so everyone,
everywhere. Yeah,
right. So everyone basically got the 40-bit version, and eventually, again, fortunately, the the sides of the angels won, as I would characterize it. And
but we are still, but there's a long term consequence. That's the other. That's the real import of this. Is that even that misguided law plagues us still today?
It does. That's a great point. The other thing, though, is in response, Congress passed another piece of legislation that people tend to forget about, which is known as the CALEA, the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act. Mm-hmm. And this was the counterpart. This is, again, there's always two parts to this going on. This was the counterpart to the encryption part. Okay, fine, you can have your encryption, but we're going to do this. And that's why all communications hardware and now software with all these telecommunications companies has vendor ports. Or why AT&T has that unmarked room in their systems. Those are not AT&T, you know, kind of gets an unfair, and Verizon get a bit of an unfair rap. They are legally compelled to have those by an act of Congress. Like, they're not providing vendor ports and these unmarked rooms because they're kissing up to the government. Like, it is because of the Communications for Law Enforcement Act, which came about in response to the cyber wars debate, and was like, fine, you can have your encryption, but we're going to build it. But in that case, we get capabilities to capture everything. And that's where all this data collection and stuff that was revealed by Edward Snowden and stuff, it all stems from this act, which, again, just to reemphasize, there's multiple, it's all a security debate, but there's different parts of security. And I think what the FBI is trying to accomplish here is the equivalent of the CLIA Act. They're trying to say, fine, we'll let you have your encryption, at least for now, but we want to weaken or have access to against all your other security measures in the meantime.
Anything more to say before we move on? I mean, this is a good conversation. I think the facts are now fairly well known.
You know, there's a couple things that I thought of here. One is, you know, you mentioned that a lot of this dates back to the 1990s. At the beginning of the 21st century, Microsoft actually proposed and was ready to introduce, I think in 2003 or 2004, I don't know if you were there at the time, Ben, but Palladium.
Oh, yeah.
Which became formally named the Next Generation Secure Computing Base, mm-hmm. which was essentially this. It's essentially what Apple has now. And many of the pieces of what Palladium proposed have made it into the existing PC hardware today. So you have TPMs and you have, you know, BitLocker encryption that uses that. And you've got, the equivalent. PCs for several years have had the equivalent of Apple's Secure Enclave on them. But the point of bringing up Palladium is that when it came up in 2003, it was shouted down hard and loud by the same people who are now rooting for Apple to win this.
We saw it as a grab, a power grab by Microsoft that would allow them to keep non-Microsoft software off their system, things like that.
Right. No, yeah. I think that the bigger point that it's making is the capability that allows only Apple to install firmware here, which there's another point to be made here, by the way, but that's the root of the walled garden. I mean, that's the fact that only Apple can install an iOS device. And by the way, this gets at why the FBI is definitely making case. If the FBI really wanted to get down this phone, it's widely believed that the government, at least the NSA anyway, whether they want to share it or not, has zero-day exploits that they spend a lot of time and money researching and understanding that would allow them to install the firmware themselves. That would defeat this, at least this 10 attempt before wipe sort of thing. So, and what those zero-day exploits are about is about defeating the requirement that all software, that the core operating system software be signed by Apple. Which, you know, yes, there's lots of people who are on Apple's side right now that a week ago were opposed to the requirement that Apple sign all the software because it's my device and I should be able to run whatever software I want on it, et cetera, et cetera.
That's the reason Palladium was killed. Because Microsoft could keep anybody else from opening a Word document, for instance, or installing anything but Microsoft Windows on their PC.
But I do think you bring up a good point, Ben, which is the fact that, I mean, and I've heard from a lot of people, been talking to a lot of security professionals, a lot of hackers who more than just the NSA, people believe they can get into this phone and that there are other vectors to get into this phone.
John McAfee thinks he
can. Well, okay. But I'm talking about confidence.
He says he could do it with social engineering. His team of social engineering hackers. I'm not sure exactly who you would call fool to get into that phone.
Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
No, I'm talking about actually competent people. I'm not talking crackheads, but alleged crackheads.
Allegedly.
But I think that brings up an interesting point, which is it'll be interesting to see when this gets further into court is how much, you know, the FBI, their position, the Department of Justice's position is very clearly that the reason that they're going to Apple is because Apple is their only hope. You know, help us, Apple, you know, Tim Cook, Kenobi, you know, you're our only hope. But that doesn't seem to be the case. And it'll be interesting to see if that impacts this case or not, and how that impacts the burden, because I know that behind the scenes there are a lot of security professionals who are actively offering their services, and I've heard that there are kind of two levels of people at the FBI. There's kind of the higher political level where they do see this as kind of a bigger political case, and there's a bigger statement to be made, and then there are the people who are actually just wanting to work the case, who just want to get into the phone and see if they can actually just, you know, work what's happening, and so that disconnect that's even happening, you know, at that level on the law enforcement side is interesting too.
Yeah.
I think one thing that really highlights this fact that the same Apple capability that is keeping this phone secure is also the one that, you know, lots of people have been annoyed about, to put it kindly, gets to the fact that all this stuff has trade-offs, and the trade-offs get really extreme when it comes to anything involving encryption. You know, it's very much a all or nothing sort of proposition. I mean, it's math at the end of the day. Like, you're either going to get one answer or you're not. And that is what makes this case tricky. And I'm not sure it's one of those things where being an absolutist, you may be right, but there's a danger of winning battles and losing wars here, I think. That's why I think it's useful to think about these different layers, because it's very possible to be narrowly right on one issue. And if you're not aware of and acknowledging the trade-offs that has at other issues, there's no question that encryption makes the job of legitimate law enforcement more difficult. And there's nothing wrong with admitting that that's the case. The burden is on us in the technological community to make the case why that trade-off is worth it. And one thing that I think would be very helpful, I absolutely believe in a right to privacy, and I think that that's an important reason to have encryption. I'm concerned that's not the best political argument to make. The fact of the matter is there's a long history of people willing to throw away other people's privacy if it makes them feel more secure. But there's an even better argument here. This is a security argument. Like, there are legitimate security reasons. If you care about being safe, if you want to be safe, then you're not you don't get to just find, I'll trade away some privacy for security. No, in this case, you are trading away better security for a short-term sense of feeling secure. Like, Apple actually has, the FBI shouldn't be able to make the argument that this is security versus privacy argument, and we're so sorry we have to violate privacy this one time. Like, the argument to be made, and I think the winning political argument, is that what the FBI is asking may help them in the short term, but in the long term, it's making us, everyone, the U.S., every single citizen, less secure. Because that absolutely, it happens to be true. And that's, I think, when it comes to that PR level, that's something that I think all of us could do a better job articulating. It's not just about privacy. Privacy is important. And believe me, but the thing is, we're preaching to the choir when it comes to privacy. I think everyone listening to this show, everyone on here, by and large, agrees with that. But when it comes to winning hearts and minds, which is going to have to be done with this, there's a security argument to be made in favor of this, and it's the right one.
Well, it's not the end of the line. This is going to go on. Apple's going to respond. This story is going to go on, but this is also going to be the first of many attempts in a variety of ways, I think, to break encryption. Why is this also partly an issue of digital technology being treated differently than non-digital analog technology? In other words, if the police have a search warrant for my home, they can search my home. If there's a lockbox in the home and the warrant covers it, they can get into it. If it's a Chubb safe and they can't open it, they can go to Chubb and say, help us open it. None of that is debated. Why is this treated so differently?
I don't think it should be.
It's the encryption issue, because the encryption is breakable or it's not. Like, encryption forces this to be.
Well, let's say there were an unbreakable safe.
But there isn't, Leo. That's the entire point. Whereas encryption is. Like, and so that's what makes it that. And the problem is you either fundamentally flaw encryption. I think I just use flaw as a verb. or you don't. Like, that's what forces this to be.
I should point out, you can't break math. Encryption will continue to be possible. Strong encryption will still exist. It just means that Apple's version of it, or Google's, or whoever is forced to provide a backdoor, will no longer be reliable. But it doesn't break encryption. It just means your Chubb safe is no longer uncrackable. I'm not sure that that's a huge moral hazard. If you want privacy, you just don't use an iPhone. And after all,
well, so what do you use instead, Leo? Because
PGP. GPG, which is open. There is nobody to compel to give you a backdoor in GPG. And if there were, because it's open source, it'll be immediately obvious.
But I guess my point is, I mean, this is the sort of thing that on any level phone, if you're wanting to get into it, I mean, you're talking about Apple's encryption, but I'm saying, okay, so, but.
Well, if you want privacy, the idea of carrying a smartphone and wanting privacy seems to be a contradiction in terms. If you want privacy, you should not be carrying a smartphone.
Well, this is why this is a question of principle. Ultimately, is the burden on the customer to enforce their own constitutional right?
You don't have a constitutional right to privacy.
You don't. Supreme Court precedent would disagree with you.
Supreme Court might say so, but it is not a constitutional right.
The Ninth Amendment might disagree a little bit, but.
Well, so I mean, not
you have a right against unreasonable search and seizure.
The Supreme Court is responsible for interpreting the Constitution, and so they
say it's a constitutional right to privacy.
Is that it is a constitutional right? The penumbras and enumbras of the Constitution, of the various amendments. It's not just the Fourth Amendment; it's a few different ones. Has been found to make it so that people can't stop you from using contraception or abortion, which is why the other issue is why the privacy. Right. This is why this political issue is so complicated. I mean, when you talk about a right to privacy, there is a segment of this country that their ears perk up and they hear abortion, because that's at the root at the root of that. And again, that's what makes
it's
so
Ninth Amendment most cases. Yes,
that makes it so harrowing politically. I mean, the other issue is, this is not Apple. This is not just about. Right. This issue, this should be four layers. The fourth layer is this isn't just a U.S. issue. This is about Apple selling in other countries. The most obvious example is China, where all reports indicate that, Apple has successfully resisted similar requests from the Chinese government for things like golden keys.
They actually said on a call with press on Friday that China has never asked them for what the FBI is asking them for now.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
I would parse whatever statement they made. I would parse those words as carefully as possible.
The whole issue in China is complicated. I mean, like, for example, iCloud data is hosted by China Unicom, not by Apple. Right. And, there is speculation that allows Apple to say that our data, we don't allow anyone access to data that we host.
Although at this point, iCloud data is not encrypted anyway.
Do you not think, though, that there is some balance that we could strike that would help us fight terrorism, fight criminality without... as I said, if you really wish to have privacy, this does not... This means you can't carry an iPhone. Let's say this all goes through. You could... And at some point, there's a golden key for the iPhone or for Windows or whatever. Doesn't mean you cannot pursue privacy. It just means that this device can't. And frankly, I again would say if what you want is privacy, you shouldn't be carrying a smartphone with you, right? I mean, how can you protect somebody's privacy if they've got a GPS device with a microphone and a camera in their pocket that's broadcasting on the internet? How can you? That seems like a that seems like a lot to ask.
Well, I mean, Leo, I don't think
that we have a requirement to make sure that somebody can take, like, you should be able to go jump off a cliff without hurting yourself. That's not a requirement. You can still pursue privacy if you wish. Just don't carry one of these around.
Well, I appreciate you making the point, Leo, because I do think that it's easy for us in tech to just dismiss, you know, very legitimate arguments on the other side. I would push back on 2 points. One, I already made the point that it's not my responsibility to guarantee my ability to speak freely, for example, to enforce my right to free speech. That burden falls on the government. The burden falls on the government to respect rights that are enshrined in the Constitution. So that's one. Two, this is why the argument, this is a political argument ultimately, because the fact of the matter is, at the end of the day, the threat from terrorism in the United States has been dramatically oversold and leveraged to
make that's all a kinds of changes. That's a political argument, and that can be debated.
But you're making a political argument as well. You're making a political argument that concern about terrorism ought to trump rights.
No, that's not the argument I'm making. I'm asking if there is some balance that we can make between protecting ourselves and protecting our security and absolute protection of privacy. I think it's kind of absolutist to say, well,
this is why
in no circumstance should the FBI have be able to search my phone under no circumstances.
That's fine. But this is why the argument is not to make a privacy argument, even though, one, I will go to the mat with you on it. But two, I will respond to you by saying, OK, Mr. Leo Laporte, devil's advocate, you say you care about security. Well, let's back up and consider security as a whole and not in this one particular case. If you look at security from a systematic basis, the fact of the matter is the United States collectively has more to lose from bad security than any other country in the world, one.
Yeah.
And two, we have more capabilities of overcoming security than any other country in the world. So if we want, on balance, to be in a better position from security, we ought to encourage broadly available technologies like encryption.
And then just make sure everybody has an Internet of Things device or two in their house.
Right, exactly, which we can take advantage of. I mean, if you want to get back to nuts and bolts, that's the exact argument. You can make the security argument that, like, if you want the US to be more secure and security.
Make sure
is
there's good strong encryption widely people, available.
Right?
And make sure everybody has an Amazon Echo in the house.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the FBI is so focused on, like, offense, right? Like, they're like this misbalanced basketball team that all they're focused on is about how can we score the most buckets? How can we get the most data? But to win a game, you have to play offense and defense. And the problem is the FBI is seeking to fundamentally compromise the U.S.'s defensive capabilities in order to score more buckets, with the unwitting reality that that's a bad trade-off, because if everyone has the same level of defense, the U.S.'s, like, innate offense is so superior to anyone else that we don't need to weaken our defense to have a systematic advantage. And then the problem is the FBI, again, they're just so focused on their problems. They're not focused on, and this is why the NSA supports strong encryption. The NSA wants nothing better than to spy on everyone. So why do they support encryption? Because if you look at it on balance in a systematic sort of way, you can understand that everyone having the same level of defense is an advantage to the country that has the best offense. That's the United States, and it will be for the foreseeable future.
Ed Bott, should Apple just say, yeah, whatever you need, we'll do it?
No, of course they shouldn't say that. I think the larger issue that we have here, though, is one of a complete lack of confidence in the United States criminal justice system. That's the root.
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
That's the root of the problem here.
They need help.
Well, and the other thing is that the law enforcement people, maybe I'm biased because I happen to know a few FBI agents, but I know that they wake up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat thinking, did I forget something today? Is my phone going to ring with somebody telling me the thing we were afraid of just happened? And I think that's their motivation. I don't think there's petty politics involved here. I think it is coming from a sincere place from them. But the fact is that what they're asking for here, essentially they're asking for Apple to set up a dedicated criminal justice lab that they can come to with a warrant and say, look, we got a judge to give us this warrant. Help us unlock. We have physical possession of this device. It has information on us. Help us unlock it. If you could actually create a system like that where everyone's phone was safe, the only people who could break into it were Apple, and Apple would only do it in their secret lab with a court order, that would probably be okay, except that nobody has any confidence in that outcome actually happening. And nobody has any confidence in those warrants that are being issued being trustworthy, because we have a history of the FISA court rubber stamping those warrants for the last God knows how many years.
That's a really interesting thing to say. And I like it, which is, if we knew that this could just be restricted to this phone and to...
But it can't be.
But it can't be.
Well, not no, just that, but... Should only the U.S. be able to ask Apple to use a secret lab? Should the Chinese government be able to ask them?
Right.
I mean, the Chinese government.
If you do business in China, you have to adhere to the laws of the Chinese government, right?
It opens up a lot of precedents that I don't think that go way beyond this case. But even just in taking it just to this case, of course it can't just be restricted to this phone. That's such a ridiculous argument. I mean, because the they can very easily get a warrant to change the software to make it be done elsewhere. And as Jonathan Zdziarski said, you know, the fact that they would have to go through testing policies to prove that the software they're creating was valid, it would have to go through labs. This isn't one of those things where no matter what that this, you know, court order says, oh, you can just keep it on your campus. Right. That's simply not true, because that's not how the forensics testing works. Right. There's many layers.
That Zdziarski post is well worth reading, because it may in fact be Apple's defense. We don't know what Apple's going to say on the 26th, but in the court order, one of the defenses Apple would have is that it's an undue burden for them to create this tool. And if it in fact is a true forensics tool, it's a massive burden. And it's a business that Apple's not in. They're asking Apple to do something that they don't do, which is create forensics tools. And I think that might actually be Apple's defense. I do want to say one thing, though, and I think it's really important to say this, which is I come from a point of view, perhaps foolish, of assuming that everybody in this is acting, they believe, in the best interest of the American people and of our security. I don't think the people involved in this are malicious actors. I think we can disagree about what is the best way to go. And I think that one of the reasons Tim Cook wrote this public post is he wanted this discussion to happen. He wanted people like you, Ben, to say, okay, I understand why you want this, but you have to really understand the consequences of a golden key, and it's so far-reaching, it actually, and this is the most important argument to make to the FBI, hurts our long-term national interest and our long-term national security. And if you can make that argument successfully to Congress, to the FBI, to law enforcement in general, I think I like you, Ed, I know many people in law enforcement. There are people, high-up people in the Department of Justice who listen to this show, I know, on a regular basis. And I think it's really important that we not come from the point of view that they're malicious actors. No, they're acting in what they believe is our best interest. And it's important to have this conversation so that they understand, everybody understands the full consequences of this.
And that is something that, unfortunately, in the initial rush to judgment on this, there is an unfortunate assumption from Silicon Valley that the motives of the government are evil, plain evil.
That's kind of what I want to separate out. There's an anti-government streak that I understand, and I maybe don't even disagree with it. But that is not really where the conversation needs to go, because that's a different that's a political conversation, and there is an art there. You know, once you start saying, well, I don't trust the government anyway, they should never have this ability, you've kind of really lost your moral standing to have this discussion. I think Ben's argument is much stronger, frankly.
I completely agree. And I think that's something that the point that we're all in the same boat here. I mean, this is a political fight, and being an ideologue about this is not going to help. again, you might win a battle, but you're going to lose the war. And I think that's a great reminder wheel and something to bring up. One thing I do think that and actually I would almost use an example. I think this Jonathan Zarsky post was very good and excellent, and he's had a couple of really good posts. I'd be wary of, for example, I would bet the FBI should this post or similar argument come up and say, "Oh no, we don't want to make a forensic tool," and then the guy's already dead. His defense lawyer is not going to make us verify it. Blah blah blah. This is why it comes down.
Like, it's broader reaching than just this case.
Well, it's about precedent. It's about once the FBI. It's in the FBI's interest to make this as narrow as possible. So, for example, they're making it. That's why Apple can do it on their labs, and they can make it for this one phone. And Apple can make this for one phone. The issue, of course, is that Apple can easily make it for another phone once it's done. And so the FBI is going to keep this as narrow as possible. And frankly, you know, just as an observer and a, you know, former recovering constitutional law student, this is a very nice case because it is so clear cut. It comes down to a matter of principle and of this interpretation of the All Writs Act. And I see, you know, it's kind of cliche to say, oh, this ought to go to the Supreme Court. The reality is that the vast majority of cases don't go to the Supreme Court. It's a very few number of cases per year. But this one is so clear cut, and it's so clearly a matter of like there are arguments to be made on both sides that I think it will. And it's going to be fascinating to watch it unfold for sure.
All right. We spent an hour on it, an hour we needed to spend, and I think very, really, really informing and valuable discussion. So thank you. Anything, Christina, you want a final word too?
No, I mean, a lot's been said. I think this will go to the Supreme Court. I think that this is much bigger, though, than just this case. And I think that's why there are so many opinions on both sides and why it's such a difficult conversation to have, because it's not just about this one phone. It's about a lot more. And what that means down the line, we'll see. It'll be interesting to see Apple's response on Friday.
Absolutely.
And to see that's going to be the next big.
And I have no doubt that right now in Cupertino, there are similar conversations going back and forth about what is the best course.
Well, there's one more angle too. I mean, first off, this was the 5C, which these restrictions can be overcome by updating the operating system. Basically, the operating system enforces the 10 passcode limit. This would be significantly more difficult on the 5S and on in because the 10 limit and the delay between tries is enforced by the secure enclave. The secure enclave is basically a separate computer within the iPhone. It's its own silicon. It's its own software. And Apple's contention on background has been that, well, yes, but the same technique could apply, which basically means Apple could update the secure enclave to overcome this sort of thing. I think what's going to be interesting from my perspective it's too late for next year, but maybe the year after that is the counting, this 10 password counting, or the delay, at least. Probably the delay would be the more likely thing. Is that going to be etched into the silicon? So basically Apple's going to be like, well,
we can't
the only
that.
Way
Sorry.
To overcome this is, yeah, we have to build a custom chip for you.
Sorry.
Which now we're, if you want to have an unreasonable burden.
That's a good idea.
I think that's
kind of what the TPM and Palladium was all about, was hardware-based security.
And if you don't think they're already thinking about those things, I'm sure that they are. And they're also thinking about what things they can do on the software side.
But there are many in this country who would see that as treasonous, that Apple is acting in every moment to undermine law enforcement in this country. There's quite a few people who would say that.
Right, and that's why I think we should be making
this
security.
That's why this case is so interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why this is the last thing I would kind of say. What I think has been interesting about the last week is that it has been kind of this ultimate PR battle, because you have Apple obviously fighting their side. They haven't even filed a response yet, but they have filed their letter, and they've obviously had calls to people on background. And you have, you know, the FBI and the Department of Justice who are going full blast on their side. And it's at this point, even though, you know, it's ostensibly not a political case, the entire way this is being handled on both sides is as political as you can get, and it's already getting very, very ugly, and I think it's only going to get uglier.
Let's take a break. We're going to come back with more. Ed Bott is here from ZDNet. Great to have you, Mr. B. My buddy. Old friend. Also joining us, Christina Warren, my new friend. I've only known her for 5 years. Mashable.com. And my newest friend of all, Ben Thompson of Stratechery, who, man, we just love getting you on. Thank you for joining us this early hour in Taiwan.
Happy to be here.
Show brought to you today by ShipStation.com. If you are selling online, there's an ugly word, fulfillment, that you know about all about right now. That's why I want to tell you about ShipStation.com, the easiest, bestest way to manage and ship all your orders in one place. With ShipStation.com, you can import customer orders right from the website, from eBay, from Amazon, from Etsy. In fact, from more than 50 popular marketplaces and shopping carts. Then you'll easily create shipping labels for all the top carriers, and not just the Postal Service, but UPS and FedEx. You do get a free U.S. Postal Service account that gives you access to deeply discounted Postal Service shipping rates, the same rates that in the past only the biggest companies, the Fortune 500, used to get. You get it. Now they're yours. This really turns your personal small business into a fabulous, you know, big business. Or at least it looks that way, and that's nice. It's no wonder ShipStation.com is the number one choice of online sellers. An incredible 98% customer satisfaction rating. We want you to try it right now, free for 30 days. In fact, you know what? Let's double that. Let's make it a 60-day trial, but only when you use the offer code TWIT. All right? How about that? Now, here's what you do. You see up in the upper right there, heard about our ad? Click that microphone at the top of the homepage. Welcome, podcast or streaming listener. Enter your offer code and get a free 30-day trial and free bonus month. And that offer code, my friends, is TWIT. ShipStation.com solves your fulfillment woes. Do it today. ShipStation.com, we thank you for their support.
I did find the tweet I referred to earlier, which was Josh Centers. He said, Trump has picked fights with the world's three largest religions, Roman Catholicism, Islam, and Apple.
Oh, it's true. I should find, just for entertainment's sake, here's the video of Donald Trump, who, by the way, I think after this result in South Carolina, we have to start taking seriously. You can't just say, you know, this guy is probably going to be the Republican nominee, very, very likely.
So I like the idea. Boycott Apple until such time as they give that information. I think that's a great idea. Okay, yes.
That's the Donald. Actually, I think he wants to do more than boycott Apple. I think he wants Apple to bring all of its manufacturing back to the United States, which would put it out of business. So that's a good idea.
Right.
It's only the most successful company in the United States right now. Why not? Speaking of Apple, good news.
It's interesting because I think that the Apple manufacturing in China thing is it's a great example of how sound bites can replace kind of like
thought,
real understanding.
Yes. And
well, first off,
by the way, there is a huge appeal to just saying stuff like that. Cause you go, yeah. And that's it. It's just visceral. I mean, there're devils in the details. I mean, how do you build a wall? How do you ban Muslims? How do you do any of this? Doesn't matter because it makes you feel good. And,
right, but I mean that's why it's on. You know, I think it's on us, and this goes with this debate too. We can actually you can say you want to say this is about security, fine. Let's talk about security.
Right.
And actually, Apple is in the right here. Even if you think there's no right to privacy, even if you think that's all a bunch of BS, like that, fine. I'll win on a security argument.
Let's have that conversation.
Right. And I mean, you know, the Apple manufacturing point is the value add to an iPhone is dramatically in favor of the United States. The China value add is quite small. The Foxconn ad is a couple dollars per device.
What's done here in the States by programmers and engineers and designers is 90% of the iPhone's value? It's a huge amount.
Well, it's not that much. But 80%. I mean, if you go through the amount of value add to the iPhone, China is relatively low on the list. I mean, the United States is far and away number one. I believe South Korea is number two. I think Japan's number three. Taiwan's number four. I think Japan might be fifth or sixth, or China might be fifth or sixth. But I mean, it's the entire point where being there's an aspect of meeting people where they are, and that's a complicated issue to understand. People don't live and breathe this like we do. And I'm just concerned about people being so ideological and it's understandable why people believe that unequivocally Apple should do this. We got attacked. It's terrorism, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's an opportunity to win this war, not just in this case, but for the long run, which would be a tremendous benefit to technology broadly and to the United States.
This is why, you know, if you were a politician, Ben, you'd have to say, we're doing this for the children, for future generations. Just a tip next time you're running for political office.
I'll keep that in mind.
For the kids. Apple has admitted that, oops, error 53 was an error. We didn't mean to do that. And that's kind of what I thought, but weren't sure because Apple wasn't being very communicative. What, of course, happened, and we've talked about this story, we talked about it last week, was if you had a third party fix your screen, didn't even have to be the fingerprint reader, but just fix your screen, it would break the relationship between the fingerprint reader and the secure enclave. Of course, that's a security flaw. And if at that point you updated your phone, you'd brick it with the dreaded error 53. Apple said, we never intended that to happen. They released an update to iOS 9.2.1 that if you have an error 53 phone, we'll fix it. I'm not sure how you would apply that. I guess you'd have to plug it into iTunes.
That's not quite right, Leo. This was absolutely about the home button, not about the screen. Sometimes the connector would be removed in the process of replacing the screen, and that was enough. And I think Apple is speaking very carefully here. Of course, they intended to do this. And actually, this update does not restore the fingerprint sensor.
Right. And you will no longer have Touch ID.
Right.
It doesn't have to be a third party. My point was that it doesn't have to be a third party Touch ID.
Apple's error was in not having text that explained what was happening instead of displaying error 53.
Well, no,
the entire point of the fingerprint sensor, being tied in the secure enclave, is the fact that the operating system ought not to be able to interfere with that chain. And actually, that's why it's interesting. It has an interesting tie in to this encryption.
It's part of the overall security. That's right.
Exactly. And that's why, even though it's updated here, there's two things going on here. One, it's updated and they're not restoring fingerprint functionality because that defeats
restoring the functionality of the telephone.
Right, exactly. And that's what they would have intended.
And I presume at that point you could bring it into the Apple store and they would repair the secure enclave with a fingerprint reader, providing.
They can't repair. They have to replace it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Ed. Let's replace
the entire phone. Yeah. But the problem here was that they bricked the phone instead of just disabling the Touch ID capability and saying
which is incidentally what Samsung would do. Supported. Samsung has the same issue with Knox. They would make Knox no longer functioning. It would no longer have access to Samsung Pay. It wouldn't brick the phone. I think I credit Apple's saying, we didn't mean to do that. We're sorry. That wasn't the intent. Do you not think that's the case, Ed?
No. I do think that's the case. I think it was a mistake.
Apple says, we apologize for any inconvenience. This was designed to be a factory test and was not intended to affect customers. Customers who paid for an out-of-warranty replacement of their device based on this issue should contact AppleCare about a reimbursement.
Right, but I mean, again, the point was the way the error was handled. It wasn't the throwing of the error.
Absolutely, there should be a warning. Look, you may have a compromised device. We don't know what's going to happen now. You could have a Trojan on there. We don't know.
Right. Well, it's just that you have a compromised device. Fingerprint reading has been disabled.
Right.
Exactly. You know, you bring it to Apple, and then it. But then again, I mean, are you sure to break the phone? I mean.
This whole issue is
complicated. The fact of the matter is, this could be a vector to attack the security of a phone. Like we've already established that with the on-disk encryption, the disk can't be attacked directly. By far, the most efficient way to attack the disk is to attack the passcode.
Right.
And this is the fingerprint reader is a way around attacking the passcode because that's what the fingerprint reader does. I mean, the entire point here, I just found it fascinating how This is just a great example of how binary and problematic this entire issue is, because I'm not totally certain that bricking a phone when you replace the fingerprint reader, if you actually do care about security, is the worst thing in the world. It's a bad thing from a customer service perspective and from the way people experience.
I don't care that much about security. I want to use my gosh darn phone. I want to have to buy a new phone.
No, exactly, exactly.
If that's the case, it should – no, it – look, this is the law of unintended consequences. An update to the operating system is what bricked the phones that had been repaired months or a year earlier. No, this was just sloppy software engineering and not testing, because Apple employees don't have to take their phones, you know, their
That's
test
true.
Phones.
That's a good point. There was no
third
test.
Party, yes. Third party point. So they didn't test this scenario because they didn't think it was going to
well,
be.
Well, even more so, there's a psychology. Hey, if you're taking a third party repair, people, you know, all bets are off. There's the psychology of why
there's a lot of countries where there is no Apple Store.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. Like the reporter for The Guardian that discovered this.
Right.
Because he was in Macedonia.
Right. I mean, if you're in the Balkans and you need your phone fixed, you need your phone fixed. I think that it's perfectly acceptable and reasonable to say that most users should understand that if you want your phone to work the way that it should and be under warranty, you need to go to an Apple Store and pay their prices as inflated as they may be. But the fact remains that if you've got an issue with it and you need a working phone for whatever reason and you can't send it off to them or there's not a store there, repairing your phone shouldn't brick it with the software update. I think that what they're doing now does make sense. And I mean, Ben, you make a good point. There could be a potential security vector here. But I mean, if you're shutting off everything associated with a secure enclave, which is what you would hope is being done, and basically, you know, letting that just not be accessible anymore. And the only way it can be, you know, you can basically get Apple Pay back is to get a brand new phone. I think that's a fair trade-off, but I don't think it's fair if you're getting your phone fixed. And like Ed says, you get an update, everything has been working fine, and all of a sudden your phone's bricked, that you've got something that's completely useless. I mean, at least deprecate it to being the equivalent of an iPhone 5C. Don't make the whole thing useless.
Here's another. Okay, I'm not going to do all Apple today. We got a lot of stuff from Mobile World Congress that has nothing to do with Apple. But I like this story because it's I saw it local news, Channel 5 News here in San Francisco, reported on mystery noises. This is my friend Mike Sugarman, as a matter of fact, coming from a secret Apple facility in Sunnyvale.
Speculation is that Apple is
building its driverless car and testing it in here. They certainly don't want anybody to know what's going on. They got fences like this one up all over the place. Now, building the driverless car, that's no big deal. That's legal. It's nothing.
But in the middle of the night, neighbors hear clanging, banging. Trucks pull up at all hours of the day to make deliveries. And it's a neighborhood. It's not an industrial area. So neighbors have been complaining about the noise from this. Now, who knows what's really going on in there? For all we know, they're building a secret fingerprint reader.
I just love that, like that San Francisco, like it's basically turned into like TMZ.
It is.
Tech.
It is.
Like basically, you've got the paparazzi out there with like, you know, high range like cameras and microphones to pick up every little thing. That's fantastic.
They talked to the Sunnyvale City Hall and they said, "We didn't know this was going on until we saw your report on TV." So they have a permit. This is funny. Mike tries to knock on the door. They have a permit to build cars here. So they actually did apply for a permit to build cars in this facility ages ago, I guess. And maybe they've been doing it all this time.
Yeah, we're just doing some body work.
We're doing a little body work.
A couple dings and dents were taken out here.
Tim's car. We got to fix it. Who knows what's really going on?
Steve would have wanted it that way.
All right, let's talk about Barcelona. The Mobile World Congress starts tomorrow. We actually have Father Robert Ballester there and a team covering it. But, of course, today both LG and Samsung had events to show off new phones. Let's start with the LG G5 because that chronologically was the first. Nice-looking new phone. It's pretty much a kind of a reinvention of what was always a good phone, but never got much play. The G4 is a great phone. The G5 now has a pop-out modular chunk on the bottom, that will allow you to change batteries or even add more battery or and a kind of a camera button on the thing. See, there it is. It's popping out of the bottom if you're watching the video. This has been tried before by other companies. I haven't seen a modular phone in some time, though. What do you think?
I love LG's phones. I have a G4 and a V10.
Did you get the V10? That's the camera back, by the way.
Yeah.
What do you think of the V10? That's a lot bigger, isn't it?
It is considerably bigger. It's like a
6-inch, right?
Yeah, pretty close to 6 inches. Yeah. Although it's not as tall as an iPhone 6 Plus or 6S Plus. It's not as tall because it doesn't have the button. It doesn't have to have the home button at the bottom.
Right.
The button is on the back.
And they've abandoned that, which I find interesting. They've replaced that with a fingerprint reader, the kind of a Nexus 6P style fingerprint reader on the back.
Well, the V10, this is the button and the fingerprint reader are the same on the back. Yeah, although it doesn't work about half the time.
they're going to the same one that they made for the 5X. I think LG made the Nexus 5X, right? They're going to that same.
They did.
And it works really well on the 6P. In fact, it's kind of a natural way to pick up the phone and unlock it all in one swoop in it. I think it works quite well. It's going to be the Qualcomm Snapdragon 820, 4 gigs of RAM, 16 megapixel camera on the front, and it's got two cameras, and not on the front, on the back. And it's got a second 8 megapixel camera with 135 degree angle, a wide angle on the back. So not sure how those will work together, or maybe they won't. Maybe you'll just use whichever one you want to use. But in a way, that's kind of like having a Zoom.
That's similar to what the rumors are that Apple might be doing for the iPhone 7.
Right. They are going to do a dual camera, according to the rumor mill,
Right. I mean, so it's kind of a similar thing. I think this modular thing is interesting, although I'm always skeptical of anything modular, because I like the idea in theory, and I think that it's cool that you could swap out something for another battery, or you could add another accessory, or you could do other stuff. I think that's interesting. But if I'm being totally honest, it's one of those things I feel like, okay, you invested a lot of money into R&D, into development of this, and almost no one is going to use this.
But they need a differentiator? This is the hardest thing when you're making an Android
They do phone. Need a differentiator, but I guess my point is this still feels like a gimmick for gimmick's sake, that no one who actually buys the phone is actually also going to be buying the accessories, because that just, it's cool, but it seems like one of those things that's going to appeal to a very small amount of people. Like, you might buy the phone thing, I'll buy the accessories and swap stuff out, but do you really want to travel or like go around with having the different accessories in your pocket? No. I mean,
replaceable battery. I'm glad they brought that back.
Well, I mean, the reality is there's a small amount of the market for high-end Android is a small amount of people.
Right.
I mean, the market dynamics of the smartphone market are such that Apple has as a hold on it, and that hold is slowly but steadily increasing, and the sort of people who remain are the people who actually, I think, do tend to value flexibility and modularity, and that's a reason why they like Android, why they'll pay $600 for a high-end Android phone, or $500. And for that market, and this is actually why I wrote last year that I thought the S6 was a really, by Samsung, was a really poor decision. Like, you'll remember last year, Samsung focused on, we're going to have design, we're going to have all-in-one. They removed, like, a memory card, all this sort of stuff. And the S, and everyone's like, oh, the Samsung back, are they going to make a thing? And actually, the S6 was a big disappointment. And the reason, I think, was obvious. The reason is because the sort of people who were the market for a high-end Android phone value those kinds of things. That's why they like Android in the first place.
How does Android sell in Taiwan? Do you see a lot of Android phones there?
There's a fair number.
Mostly iPhone, though?
No, I think in any country the iPhone is not the majority.
It's the U.S. It's the U.S. here is where you see most of the iPhones, for sure.
Well, the U.S. is very dominant in Japan also, and you'll see, especially in first tier Chinese cities, there's iPhones everywhere
because it's a status symbol.
Right. When you talk about selling the entire ecosystem, the ecosystem isn't just apps. It's not just the hardware. It's not just the status. It's not just those things. It's all that. It's all that sort of stuff. And the Apple proposition here is very strong. Again, where the vast majority of Android sales are at the lower end of the market. So I think we're talking about a specific niche, which is high-end Android. And for the high-end Android market, which, again, these are people who could afford an iPhone, but they choose not to buy an iPhone. Right. And why would they not buy an iPhone? Well, probably because they value the things that Android brings to the table. And if you think about what they value from a software perspective, it seems natural to assume that would extend to the hardware side as well, which, again, is why I think Samsung made a mistake with the S6. Mm. I think the evidence bore that out, that it wasn't received as well as they hoped. And with the S7, which you haven't talked about yet, but they're adding back in.
SD cards are back, baby.
Right.
Exactly.
The S7 brought it back. But for this
right,
phone,
and that's why I think this LG... Well, that's why I like this LG sort of thing, because I think it's an understanding of what the high-end Android market values, and I think it's a very interesting move in that.
One of the modules you'll be able to add is a hi-fi module, a 32-bit DAC, an amplifier unit from Bang & Olufsen. They'd probably sell a few thousand of those.
I don't know if they will, though. That's the thing. A few thousand. Neil Young couldn't sell a few thousand Pono players. Yeah. You think LG is going to sell a few thousand on top of this phone that's already going after a niche market? I mean, I like the phone and I like a lot of the ideas. I just genuinely don't think that most people who even buy this phone, accepting, you know, for the reasons that Ben lays out, are still going to want to buy accessories to carry around with them. I mean,
I could see buying the camera thing. Now, it adds a big bump, but it also bumps the battery from 2,800 to 4,000 milliamp hours. That's a... Yeah. Significant size battery for a phone like this.
Put it in your pocket.
Yeah, and then suddenly you have this big bump with a camera button.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. At a certain point, it still needs to be a phone. And I mean, I think that everybody who's tried this modular stuff, it ends up not really working that well. I mean, it didn't even work that well with laptops, and that was, you know, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, and that was when it was cool to actually have like hot swappable bays in your laptop. I mean, like, I love that on my Mac, yeah. Like my PowerBook, my Pismo. Like, that was the greatest thing ever. But that was still one of those things that you didn't really see regular people doing. So even if you accept that it's going to be a high, you know, just a small percentage of people buy this and that they like these features, I still don't see. I mean, you have to carry it around. But I like the
right.
phone. I mean, I think
I know this answer, Christina. But what, I mean, what phone do you use?
Well, we know what
she obviously
uses.
I have an iPhone, but I mean, obviously.
Right?
If I were...
but the whole point is the whole. No, I that's my
so
main.
So you're
phone
the
as
wrong
well.
Judge. Is that what you're saying, Ben? She's not.
Well, I am. But I
she's not a tweaker.
I think I am a tweaker
for a lot of things. I just wouldn't want to carry stuff around with me with my phone. I mean, I appreciate being able to. For an Android phone, I still wouldn't buy.
I always used to buy second batteries or third batteries and a charger for my Samsung notes, because I loved the idea of having an extra battery in my pocket. And that was a great thing. I like that.
I'm not criticizing the battery component because I think that's actually smart. It's more like getting these other like modules that I don't think will sell. And I frankly don't think they'll make as many of them as they claim they're going to, because I don't think there's going to be an audience for that.
How about this? They've also announced a VR headset that is bucking the trend a little bit. Now, the new LG G5 is a Type-C connector. I'm happy to hear that. And, of course, Type-C, USB-C, if it's true 3.1, has a lot of throughput. And I guess it is, because their new VR headset does not hold the phone, as Samsung's does, but, in fact, just has a Type-C cable that goes down to your phone, and it's got its own built-in displays, dual 960x720 displays. It'll have support from YouTube 360 and Cardboard, so it's kind of cardboard-focused. I don't know. What do you think? This is those who wore it at Mobile World Congress today said they felt it was nice and comfortable and lightweight compared to what Samsung's been doing. Nothing to say.
I mean,
moving on. Are you gonna? I'm getting an Oculus Rift. Are you gonna get an Oculus Rift, Ed?
No.
Are you gonna get a Vive? That's apparently now also announced. For what is it, $700 or $800? Very expensive.
We don't even know. Yeah.
The HTC Vive, HTC announced it will be available later this year. That's the one that's partnered with Steam.
Ben raised the point about the market segment response. There's a high end Android segment. I'm a member of that segment, and so I look at things in a certain way. I do not understand, outside of some gaming applications, some line of business type stuff that might, you know, the classic one is real estate for virtual tours, but I'm not sure that there's any other business scenarios for virtual reality beyond things like that. A few tens of thousands of people in Silicon Valley, I'm not sure who else is going to spend the money on these VR headsets.
Gamers, for sure.
That was the first thing I mentioned.
They spend a lot of money.
Well, fine, but they are also a niche market. They pay for high-end video cards and high-end sound cards, and they're the ones still buying desktop PCs with modifications and fans and water cooling systems and all that crap. But there's not, you know, there's not a lot of them either. To Christina's point.
Well, there's not a lot of them relative to smartphones. I mean, the gaming market remains massive. I mean, the gaming industry makes more revenue than the movie industry. I mean, it's a very large market, and I do think that's the focus, and that's why I'm a little more skeptical of these phone solutions. Right. I mean, the advantage of the phone is that you, especially, and this is why the LG one doesn't make as much sense to me. The advantage of the Samsung is that you're actually using your phone. Now you're kind of duplicating the cost, which, you know, I think it's not surprising that VR is starting with gaming because, yeah, to Ed's point, these are people who have a demonstrated willingness to pay.
Right.
If you like how technology is advanced, you could thank a gamer because it was, after all, for many years, only gamers who were pushing processors and graphics cards to get better and better and better.
Without a doubt.
That's who was spending money on that stuff.
That will be the case with VR too. I mean, it'll eventually go into other ways, and we keep seeing them kind of try to get into more of the consumer oriented spaces, you know, the Samsung VR and this LG headset, but the software is going to have to get there too. And I think that right now, I mean, most of the VR software developers I talk to are focused on more of the high end stuff and more of the gaming things. So, you know, it'll trickle down, but it might take some time.
Let's take a break, 'cause I do want to talk about Samsung's Galaxy announcements. There were quite a few, and, Samsung might have made a little tactical error at their event as well. We'll talk about that. Our guests today, Christina Warren, film girl from Mashable. Love having you on the show. Thank you for being here. From beautiful somewhere in New Mexico, Ed Bott from ZDNet. You could tell by the knotty pine and the New Mexico flag behind him. And the ceiling fan earlier, we saw that. Is it hot there?
It's been warm. The weather's about to turn cold again, but it's ridiculous. We're in Santa Fe here, we're having record temperatures.
It's been a crazy winter.
It's just insane.
Even in New York, right?
It's supposed to snow on Tuesday. So
what?
Yeah.
Does it snow a lot in Santa Fe?
Yeah, we're up at 8,000 feet.
Okay.
It's the southern tip of the Rocky Mountains here.
And recovering from his New Year's celebrations. In Taiwan, of course, Ben Thompson of Stratechery. Was it a good Chinese New Year this year? Did you have fun?
It was.
Go to the parade?
There's always random kind of temple
parades.
We
get parades here. You know, that's the big thing in San Francisco is the parade. That was last night, actually. A little late.
A little late, yeah.
Yeah.
A couple weeks ago.
Our show today brought to you by Gazelle. Perfect timing, all these new phones and devices coming out. Maybe it's time to shed the old phone, and certainly don't want to throw it in a drawer where it's just going to gather dust. You wouldn't do that with a $100 bill, would you? Go to gazelle.com. At least find out what that old device is worth. Gazelle's paying cash on the barrel head for all sorts of old devices, even broken iPhones or iPads. They'll give you money for that. The nice thing is you're getting a guaranteed quote that's good for 30 days. So you're locking them in for the next month. That gives you time to figure out what you want, get the new phone, transfer your data, and then send it to Gazelle. They'll pay the postage to send you a box, prepaid shipping, and all of that. In fact, get a bunch of old devices, pile them in, and get a check in the mail from gazelle.com or a PayPal credit or an Amazon gift card. Now, once you've sold Gazelle, now, maybe. Look at that. Can you believe a Galaxy Note 3 is worth $75? I mean, that's like ancient. That's a good deal. Now, once you've sold, maybe you want to talk about buying Gazelle. A lot of times people don't want to buy a brand new device for a kid, or maybe it's your third phone this year because you keep breaking them, or maybe you just, you know, want to save a little money. You can get new phones, pre-owned phones from Gazelle as well. New iPads, new iPhones, Galaxy phones as well. Gazelle. They will help you finance them. They offer financing on all devices from Affirm. That's really easy. You can do it right on the Gazelle page. You just give them some basic information. You'll get approved instantly. You can pay it off in 3, 6, or 12 months through your bank account. through your check, your debit card. Just select financing with a firm at checkout. They also offer a special 12-month warranties for cell phones and iPads that cover everything, water damage, cracked screens, hardware defects. This is through Assurant. So really, Gazelle's become an even more full-service place to buy as well as sell. Help is available 24/7 if you need it to process claims, to return your device. Gazelle, I love them. Gazelle.com. Go there right now. Never extend your contracts. Just buy a new phone at Gazelle.com. Of course, it'll work with all the major carriers. You just don't owe them your life for the next 2 years. Give new life to used electronics. Trade them in for cash or buy certified pre-owned. Visit Gazelle.com today. We had a great week this week talking about the Apple news and Mobile World Congress. If you missed anything, these are some of the highlights from this week on Twit.
Previously on Twit.
Roger Anderson, you created this bot.
I get a lot of scammer telemarketers.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no, totally fine.
What are you calling about again?
I'm calling about smart pants.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to order some?
Oh, geez. Hang on. There's a bee on me. Hang on. There's a bee on my arm.
Twit live specials.
This is Developer Week in San Francisco. It's a celebration of the people who like to build, who like to make, who like to create.
Matter of seconds, you can know precisely what's in your water. We can check for corrosion, heavy metals.
This Week in Google.
Judge has ruled that Apple must help the government unlock and decrypt an iPhone.
What is it they could want out of that phone? Anything that was done in terms of phone calls, there's a separate record of the phone company. I would just suggest you weigh carefully the balance here to say that this is a huge and important precedent. For what end? The miscreants are dead.
The U.S. government has asked us for something we simply do not have and something we consider too dangerous to create. That's an important phrase.
That's the key of it all.
Mm-hmm. We don't have it, but we could create it is what I'm how I'm reading that.
Twit. For justice.
For justice! We have a big week ahead, too, as a matter of fact. Unfortunately, we have Megan Maroney and Jason Howell, our TNT team. Jason, what's ahead this week?
Thanks a lot, Leo. Here is a look at some of the things we're going to be keeping a close eye on in the upcoming week on Tech News Today. First of all, Apple versus the FBI and the backdoor access to the iPhone will undoubtedly continue on throughout the week. We're going to be keeping tabs on that as that story progresses. Also, Mobile World Congress starts tomorrow officially. We're going to be talking all about the many announcements, including Samsung and LG's product announcements from earlier this morning. We're going to have Father Robert Ballesteros there throughout the week with reports from the show in Barcelona. We'll see if we can't get him on and maybe get him to bring back some jamon with him when he comes back. And finally, HP and Salesforce have their earnings calls this Wednesday, February 24th. And you know what? News is always breaking, so Megan Maroney and I will do our part to break it all apart every weekday at 4 p.m. Pacific on Tech News Today. That's a quick look at the week ahead. Back to you, Leo.
All right. Thank you, Jason Howell. Tech News Today, every Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern here. And, of course, as he said, the Apple topic will live forever. But it's not the only news story. Mobile World Congress begins well, really, it began in effect today after Samsung's event. We did broadcast live coverage of Galaxy Unpacked 2016. You can watch it on our Twit Live specials channel. And there was quite a surprise. At one point, after showing off the new phone, showing off a new camera, they asked the journalists in that giant hall to put on VR helmets. And look who was in the middle of the stage. Lo and behold, Mark Zuckerberg. He'd already come out while everybody was looking at the video on their Gear VR. And apparently chaos ensued. People rushed to the stage to take pictures. Nobody was listening to anything Mark was saying. It was just because it's like, The Verge said, it's like Justin Bieber just appeared out of nowhere. There were gasps, screams, people fainted. No, I'm exaggerating, but there was a lot of excitement. Mark was there, obviously, to show Facebook's support. They own Oculus, and Oculus uses Samsung's technology in its Oculus Rift. And, of course, the Oculus technology label is on the Gear VR, those little basically holders for your smartphone that Samsung sells. Let's talk about the Galaxy S7. See, you dissed the S7. I think it was Ben. The S6. I love the S6. I thought it was one of the most beautiful phones I've ever used. It functionally, it had lots of problems, as many Android phones do.
I didn't diss the phone itself. I'm saying it was a bad fit for the market.
It didn't sell well. I think the sales figures
bore that out. Yeah.
But that could just be a reflection of how tough it is to succeed in the high end when you're competing against an iPhone, frankly.
The problem is that there is a perception that my contention is that the common perception is that high-end Android phones like the S6 previously and the LG and the other ones are competing against the iPhone for high-end customers. And my contention is that that competition is largely over. They are actually competing with each other for high-end Android customers, which is a distinct customer base from the iPhone. These are people who have had the opportunity over many years now to buy an iPhone. They choose not to. And my further contention is that these people value their what they value is different than your typical iPhone customer. So creating a product in the S6 that apes the iPhone in being a beautiful piece of engineering, a beautiful piece of hardware, everything all built in. You can't add memory cards. You can't replace the battery, all this sort of stuff. That Samsung was misunderstanding their competitive position. I wrote this when they announced it a year ago. And, and I thought that the projection that, now they have high design, they're going to sell a lot of them was actually, no, they're actually going to sell fewer. And that's what turned out to be the
case.
They
said they listened and they gave us more of what we wanted. As you pointed out, they put an SD card slot in. They also made it waterproof, which notably the S6 was not. I don't know how important that is. I guess people drop their phones in toilets a lot. But this is very much a design forward phone. It's not as if they've abandoned it. In fact, they've gone metal. It's black onyx and gold platinum. And also in the Edge, silver titanium. They've gone big. The S7 Edge is, 5.5 inches? And the S7 itself is 5.1 inches. They're, I think, quite stunning. In fact, I can't wait to get my hands on the new S7 Edge. They have also added an interesting feature, a lower pixel count camera. They've gone from 16 to 12 megapixels. And just like HTC before them and others, they've said, well, no, bigger pixels are better. They're going to gather. I think Google said this with the 6P. Bigger pixels are going to gather more light.
HTC went to like 4 megapixels.
Yeah, HTC went a little too. They went to 5. They may have gone a little bit too far. They are using an interesting technology. I don't know if it's a Sony sensor. That's one of the problems that these companies have. They're all using essentially the same Sony part in their camera. This one is f1.7, which is extremely fast, much faster than the f2.2 iPhone 6S. And they are using some sort of technology that allows the pixels themselves to focus. Apple uses some pixels for focusing, but Samsung says they're going to use all of the pixels. I don't know what this means. It's just a gobbledygook to me to focus. But they did say it will focus much faster. Also, giant batteries, a 3,000 milliamp hour in the smaller S7 and in the 5.5-inch S7 Edge, 3,600 milliamp hours, which is a lot of juice. That's listening too, isn't it? I think that's responding to many Android users who say battery life needs to improve. Ed, which phone do you use? Use a Nexus?
No, I have the G4 and the V10.
That's right. You said you like the Nexus.
I just switched to the V10. I had a Nexus 6P, but it for whatever reason, and I worked with Google support on it for the Project 5 support team, and it would take 45 seconds to open a web page on any Wi-Fi network that I was on. And they sent me another one and it had the same problem. And I found other people who had the same problem. So I couldn't use, I wanted to try the Nexus 6P, but that's kind of a deal breaker when a web page takes 45 seconds to load.
Yeah.
So I'm back to the G4 has been just a marvelous phone. It's one of the best cameras I've ever had.
Compare then this G5 to the S7. Are you still, you think you'll stick with LG?
For now, yeah, they're making wonderful products. They're really doing some very, very smart engineering, and I don't see a lot of gimmickry in what they're doing either.
Samsung, of course, the king of gimmickry.
of gimmickry.
the challenge here is the order in which people make decisions. I believe that people first choose iPhone or something else. And then they choose, once they decide on something else, or they explicitly choose Android, then they decide, do I want the Samsung or the LG or whatever? The problem for Samsung and LG and all these sorts of guys is they can't change that equation. They don't have the control to change that. And so all they can focus on is the hardware aspects of their devices. If customers made a decision, well, I'm going to treat all these as equivalents and then choose the best one. I mean, this is nothing new. This is a replay of I used to always chuckle when you would read reviews and like PC Magazine or whatever back in the day of like the new Apple laptop. And then at the end, they do like the compare and like, well, this compared to the ThinkPad, to the Dell, to the whatever. And it's like, if someone is choosing an Apple laptop, they're almost certainly not even considering the Windows laptops. Like it's not, you're setting up a false comparison. And obviously that was at a much smaller scale than what is going on with phones. But I think it still holds. I mean, so it's fun to talk about the Samsung features relative to an iPhone, but it's a purely academic debate that I don't think has much that will really matter.
Are they making the same mistake that you thought they made last year? Is there too much design and too little
tweakability? Oh, I have no problem with too much design.
The Android market.
Better. No, I don't think, I'm not saying Android people want like,
ugly phones? We do. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Give me an ugly phone.
My entire point was by they went so extreme with the S6, like basically cutting out all extensibility and all ability to tweak. I just think they did it to take on the iPhone, which I think was just a misunderstanding of where the market was.
No, and I welcome the return of the SD card slot. But I have to say, it really feels like a very fragmented market where essentially you decide, I like this, and people are brand loyal and don't change a lot. I mean, I think Ed's going to stick with LG for some time to come and not be tempted.
The danger is losing what you have. And I think Samsung, that's what happened with Samsung last year was – they lost customers because that's the hidden cost of features and being tricky or clever or whatever you've characterized Samsung as being. And this is something that I think Microsoft really had to learn. I remember it was it's way harder to take things away and unwrap things than it is to add them in the first place.
Yes.
And that's something that Samsung learned last year.
The power
and
of no.
Well, there was a double whammy for Samsung, which was Apple introducing large phones finally. So there were a lot of people who were buying Samsungs or some other fairly large, Droid, Motorola, whatever, a fairly large phone because the Apple phones were just too small. The iPhone 5, especially if you're of a certain age and your eyes aren't you don't have the vision of a red-tailed hawk anymore. An iPhone 5 was not an option, and the larger screen was much easier on an older demographic. And there's plenty of people in an older demographic who are still willing to spend money on it. But once Apple got in there with the 6 Plus and the 6S Plus, all of a sudden, oops, that didn't become the critical differentiator anymore. Oh, there's now an iPhone that's big enough for me. Fine, I can switch back.
I would say Samsung's new plan is to really create an Apple-like ecosystem with lock-in. And it's very clear, their watches are they're really not doing the Android Wear anymore. It's Tizen. And their VR helmet only works with Galaxy. In fact, they are even if you pre-order Galaxy S7 when it goes on pre-order in 2 days on the 23rd,
free.
You get the VR and 6 games for free. That's very interesting.
That's smart. That probably means they haven't sold a lot of Galaxy VR or Gear VRs.
Quite a few of them lying around.
but that doesn't mean that it's not a great pre-order gimmick. I mean, the Gear VR is not a bad product, and it certainly has more development ecosystem.
It may also herald a new marketing strategy, which is get people to order it before the reviews come out.
Right. Although, I mean, people have had the phones now for about a week, so we'll see those.
Oh, they have. Oh,
yeah, they have.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I don't know if I was supposed to say that or not.
I'm not on that list, as you might imagine.
That was a deep, dark secret. And nobody knows that all these reviews just spring up magically. Yeah.
What you don't know is when they are going to spring up. So now we know that they're going to spring up pretty soon.
Yeah, I have no idea when they're going to spring up. Yeah. I just know people have had phones. Yeah. But, I like what they're kind of returning to Ben's point, kind of, you know, bringing back the water resistance, which I think is smart, bringing back the SD card slot. I always really liked the design. I thought that the camera on the S6 Edge was great
last
year.
Love the camera.
I think one of my favorite cameras actually of the year. And we did a big camera shootout. Yeah. Ray Wong from Mashable did. And in some, it basically almost was an even split between the Samsung and the iPhone 6S. And so, they're kind of in this interesting place, like you say, Leo, where they are kind of trying to create this ecosystem, and they're succeeding to some extent. But I think the problem has been they spent all this time on the custom Samsung software that just nobody's using. You know, those apps.
Well,
and that's,
you know, Samsung Pay, 5 million people.
Well, Samsung Pay, sure, but
that's
but
a surprising success given the competition.
Well, I wonder if the success there is because it also does like the mag swipe stuff.
Right.
So I wonder if it's more about
it's the only one that does. Android Pay and right. Apple Pay both require touch.
Exactly. So they're taking advantage of the fact that it's got the NFC, it's got the mag swipe stuff, so it can be used in more places.
Right.
But even then, I haven't seen a lot of people using Samsung Pay. So we have figures to go by. But I more mean like their apps that they're building, you know, like their own, you know, notes
just
app.
Just stop doing that, please, right. Android manufacturers.
Well, that was the problem with Windows PCs for so many years. All of these hardware companies who thought that they could build a better Windows shell and shovel a bunch of utilities on there, and it was just crapware, and you have crapware on mobile devices too. And people, I'm with you, Christina. I don't know anybody who's using those Samsung apps, and I don't know why they're putting the effort into trying to maintain that.
They've kind of acknowledged it.
Ecosystem.
They killed Milk Music, right? They killed some of the milk stuff, which, by the way, very poorly named. Just poorly named here, but in Asia, milk is not a common commodity, is it? I think people don't drink milk in Asia. So
no, it's pretty rare, and the rate of lactose intolerance is much higher.
It's very
as well.
High. So it's a bizarre choice from a Korean company for the name. It isn't as if we're seeing the market leaders in a fight to the finish. There's a clear market leader in this, and it's Apple. And then it's kind of almost a battle for the scraps at this point.
Well, I think that there are two battles. There's the battle on the high end, which obviously you have like what we've seen from
and
LG
Apple doesn't
and
care about low end, right? So and that's
no, they don't exactly. Sure, but that's where the scrap battle is, and that's where you know you have your Huawei's and your Alcatel's and your Xiaomi's and your company of the week here, and then you know you have like the side stories like the Nextbit Robin or whatever, you know, the phones that will never sell any substantive amount of devices, but are interesting. We'll get some interesting stories because they have an interesting gamut, but we'll certainly never sell in large capacities. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the point. There's two markets. There's the iPhone market, and then there's really three markets. There's the iPhone market, the high-end Android market, and then there's the low-end market. And the iPhone's biggest competition is the iPhones that people already have. And when and if they decide to upgrade that. I do think Ed's point about the screen size is a good one in that it's almost the exception that proves the rule, in that the one thing that it turns out people did care about more that guided their decision before the operating system, before the ecosystem, was the size of the screen. And I think the evidence is that, you know, Apple added a ton of new to Apple customers with the new screen sizes. There's actually not that much evidence that Apple certainly probably pulled forward some upgrades, but I think the if you look at the numbers carefully, they just brought in a huge wave of new customers for the iPhone 6 specifically. And yes, certainly that was the one, you know, kind of trump card that Samsung had for a long time. It's a great point that
both Samsung and LG also announced 360-degree cameras. LG's looks a lot like the Ricoh Theta S, which I've been using.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, both of them are consumer-oriented, I think, with dual cameras and a very wide fisheye lens on each. And those are able to then stitch together into stills or 360-degree immersive video. The Samsung's looks interesting because it looks like it can do live streaming. In fact, what Samsung kind of was pushing at the event was the idea that your friends could be in Paris at the Eiffel Tower. Right. You could be at home wearing a Gear VR, of course, Samsung product, and with your Samsung Galaxy S7 phone. They're in Paris with their Samsung Galaxy S7 phone and the Samsung Gear 360 camera, and you are immersed in what they're doing in real time. That's what it looked like. I might have been reading more into it than I should have.
This is an episode of Portlandia, basically.
Does Samsung's new camera look
there actually like was. This actually was the plot of an episode of Portlandia.
It literally
from
is.
About 3 weeks ago. Literally, they decided not to go to the music festival. They would just put on the VR headsets instead on the couch and send their drone to the festival. And then they could just watch the thing. But the drone hit a biker, and the biker came to their house and beat. It's a great episode.
I love Portlandia. I'm glad it's back. Well, there you go. You're going to be living in an episode of Portlandia soon. Samsung has yet to announce a Samsung drone, however. That may be.
That's true.
It's near future.
I just have one comment.
This is
on
what they showed. These are the kids playing. Soccer in Barcelona, they show this. And you can look around and be right in the action until the soccer ball hits you, as it will in a moment.
Or hits the camera.
Right.
But the camera itself looks exactly like the original Logitech webcams.
It's a ball cam.
The little ball on a little stand.
I don't think that's an accident. I think they want it to be consumer-y and friendly.
No, I agree. It's just funny to like look at them. You're like, oh my God, this really genuinely looks like something that we had 20 years ago. But now it's a 3D camera rather than a webcam, which is interesting.
It isn't exactly super high res. It's not quite 4K. It's 30 frames per second. The stills are pretty high quality. The stills are 3840 by 1920. I'm sorry, is that video? No, that's video. So we'll see. Although John Carmack tweeted that you shouldn't go any higher than 3840 by 1920 at 30 frames per second because the Gear VR just can't handle it. That was last year. Maybe it's different this year. Anyway, I think that's a big market. I'm very excited. I have a Ricoh Theta S, and I used it on my last trip, and it was really fun. I feel like 360 video is a very exciting thing. And that's, by the way, why Mark Zuckerberg was on stage to say, yes, Facebook will support this. We believe in this and the immersive video, and... So not a surprise. All right, we're way behind. So I'm going to get to another ad, and because I want to get you out of here before the Academy Awards next week. oh my God, who's your odds on favorite for Best Picture, Christina?
I think that it's going to be.
I know what you're going to say. The Bear.
No, I think it's going to be The Big Short. Actually,
really. Okay.
I mean, if it were me, I would probably go with Spotlight.
Spotlight was boring.
I thought Spotlight was great. I think The Revenant is a great film. I think that's going to win Best Director, and Leo's finally going to get his Oscar. But based on I'm bad at this because I base this based on who's won the awards, and then you can kind of figure out like how the voting blocks are going to go. And it looks like The Big Short will be the one who takes it.
Okay.
That's the one
I haven't seen. Of course.
It's good. It's good.
Oh, I hear very good things
about it. Without a doubt, Brie Larson's totally winning Best Actress. Like, that to me is without a doubt. Like,
Vikander in The Danish Girl was so good. She's Best Actress or Supporting? She might be Supporting.
Supporting.
Okay.
She's Supporting. So Brie's biggest competition would probably have been against Charlotte Rampling from 45 Years, but Charlotte kind of killed any momentum she would have had. But Brie has literally won that award from every other award ceremony. So voting-wise, I think that she's a lock for that. And she was great in Room. She was fantastic in Room. So I think
is she the mother or the child?
The mother.
Okay. I'm watching that tonight.
She was fantastic.
In my quest to see every movie,
it's a really good film. It's a really good film.
Yeah, I liked The Danish Girl a lot. It was very touching. But I think Leo is going to beat.
Yeah, the, I, I, I think she's going to get Best Supporting Actress. I would have, like, in December, I probably would have thought maybe Rooney Mara, because I thought that Carol had a lot more heat than it ended up kind of having at award season. But I think that, Alicia Vikander is going to win for The Danish Girl.
She's so good.
Was so good.
What a moving story that is. And it's really a love story, which I thought was very interesting. It was not what I expected. And of course, Eddie Redmayne, who won the Oscar last year for his portrayal of Stephen Hawking, does it again. But I don't think he's. I think getting mauled by a bear trumps everything.
Well, and I think that it's also kind of a weird, almost. I mean, sometimes you see Oscars be awarded not just for the film in question, but for a past body of work.
Yeah.
And in this case, I actually think that his performance in The Revenant was fantastic. But I think that Leo has probably deserved Oscars in the past times he's been nominated too. He's been so good in the past, so I think it's kind of like it's finally his time.
The Revenant is a grueling movie, by the way.
It is.
And when you see horrific.
And when you see everything he did to his body and put through that, that's one of those performances that the Academy typically really likes to kind of reward, because you're really, truly going there. So I think Leo was finally going to get his Oscar.
We're talking not about me, by the way, but Leonardo DiCaprio. My Oscar is long off, I'm sure. Our show today brought to you by Audible.com. Audiobooks are the greatest thing since movies. In fact, I always think of an audiobook as a movie in your mind. Truth is, sometimes I think I've seen the movie. When I haven't, I just listened to the book, and it came to life. There, I don't care how much money they pour into a science fiction movie. There's no way those sets, that action, are going to be as good as what you can see in your head when you listen to these books. I love science fiction on Audible. I'm listening right now to Neal Stephenson's latest Seven Eves, which is really a hard science fiction book, almost like The Martian. Same kind of idea, which is you're faced with a really remarkably difficult problem, and then you use science to solve it. I'm sure he was inspired by The Martian. By the way, The Martian, also nominated for Best Picture. Best audiobook ever. You've got to listen to that. Here's the deal. I'm going to get you two books. You can listen to both of them if you want. Go to audible.com/twit2. That's twit and the number 2. You'll be signing up for the Platinum Plan. That's 2 books a month. That's my plan. And by the way, I love it. The 22nd is my renewal day, so I look forward every month. Like in 2 days, I'm going to be able to get 2 more books. There's a wish list you can add books to. So if you hear us recommend something and you're already a subscriber, add them to your wish list. But this, if you're not, this is your big chance. Get 2 books free. You'll also get the Daily Digest of the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times. You can cancel anytime in the first 30 days. You'll pay nothing. But as always with Audible, those books are yours to keep. Oh, The Help. What a great movie. But you know what? The book is even better. And the Audible version of The Help is a dramatization that just comes to life. I am a huge Audible fan. I know you know that. I don't know why you haven't tried it in the past. When you're in your car, when you're at work, when you're on the treadmill, when you're walking the dog doing the dishes, it's nothing like having a book. And if you have an Amazon Echo, man, I get home. The first thing I do is I say, Echo, read to me, and it will pick up where I left off and read my book, and that is awesome. Audible.com/twit2. Get your 2 free books right now, audible.com/twit2. How could we have buried the lead, Ed Bott? HP's Elite X3 Windows Phone.
it actually looks like a very nice device.
It uses this continuum thing, which...
corporate focus.
I mean, the idea that you could plug the phone into a keyboard, mouse, and monitor, and now it's your desktop.
Yeah. I am skeptical of the demand for that feature.
As am I. But Microsoft really seems to think it's important.
The way that this plays out, if you think into the future, this is always about skating to where the puck is going to be, right? So imagine a future where we no longer need. I mean, how many phone calls do you make on your phone anymore?
Most people don't. I don't know why we still call them phones.
Smartphone is just a computer in your pocket. So if you take if you assume that the computer functions of it are in the long run going to be more important, and that the communications aspects of it will shift into the computer part of it, and that the apps can be webified, then that's where the puck is. a couple years from now.
But I wish that they had put this phone out 2 years ago. I mean, this thing is a beast. 6 inches, quad HD, a Snapdragon 820 with 4 gigs of RAM, 64 gigs of storage, support for microSD up to 2 terabytes. There's an iris scanner. That's the Windows Hello on the front. There's a fingerprint sensor on the back. And it's a huge battery, 4150 milliamp hours. This thing is a monster.
But no apps.
But it's Windows Phone, exactly.
But it's Windows. And I mean, there are no Windows Phone apps. And even the Continuum stuff, I mean, where are the Windows apps? I mean, because your x86 stuff isn't working with this.
Well, the puck hasn't got there yet. They're skating.
I don't
is the puck ever going to get there?
Yeah. I don't think it will. I think that we kind of have gone with this mobile app ecosystem. The whole day of like HTML5 is going to save us from mobile apps thing, that turned out to be false. Yeah. I really like what they're trying to do with it. I agree with that. I think it's a really good idea. I personally don't think this is going to sell any, and I don't think the demand is going to be that great. I think HP's best bet with this will be to bundle this when they're trying to like sell their corporate customers. Like, hey, take a fleet of phones too. But I mean, you know, HP hardly has the best success record with phones.
Man, if this had, you know, so what's missing for me is my banking apps, Sonos,
Uber.
Uber for Windows Phone exists.
Okay. Is it from Uber?
It's from Uber. Yes. Native app.
Instagram's there now, right?
Yeah, but it's the beta version that they introduced 3 years ago that hasn't been updated.
That's the problem. They don't keep these up to date either.
Well, no company is going to develop, tertiary resources.
Right.
Into a platform with only 1 or 2% market share. No, the future here for a company like HP is to replace it. These become terminals.
Yeah.
These become virtual desktop.
Yeah. It's an enterprise play, as you said.
It's an enterprise play, yeah. And most tech journalists who are covering this don't understand the enterprise at all.
No,
they look at this as a pure app store play, and it makes no sense. But you know, there are scenarios where this could be a good business. There's no scenario where it topples Android or the iPhone from 1 and 2 positions.
Yeah. That's why we have Mary Jo Foley on Windows Weekly, because I neither know nor care about enterprise computing. So she talks and I don't understand what she's saying anyway. It all sounds like, you know, Hadoop, Azure, Hadoop. I don't...
There's a tremendous amount of money.
I know, I'm ignorant.
A tremendous amount of money there. A tremendous amount of value being created for the world economy. So if we're going to talk about the value that Apple brings to the American economy with its mobile infrastructure, you really should talk about the value that, you know, the boring enterprise.
So boring, though.
Well, yeah, okay. Money's boring.
Money's not boring when you have it in your pocket.
But you actually looked at is that a new phone in your pocket, or are you just being boring again?
It's so much more fun to talk about consumer stuff, and your point is very well taken, and I don't deny it. We never did an enterprise show because I couldn't find anybody to talk about enterprise. It wasn't boring.
And the people who are actually doing the work in the enterprise space are, you know, they're too busy.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's true. Yeah.
They don't want to talk.
There's so much work to do right now in that space.
By the way, I don't know if you use a Surface Book or a Surface Pro 4. I'm guessing you do. But that firmware update for me on my Surface Book fixed it.
Yeah. I have a Surface Pro 4. And yes, it's in fact, I'm over here there. Just logged me in.
The Hello works better now. I don't have the hot bag problem where you close it, but it stays on and uses battery till it's dead.
It's ice cold.
It's ice cold, baby. Yeah. Ice Surface Pro.
And so this is an interesting thing for me because I had this Surface Pro 4 was not. It was functional. It did its job, but I had to go in and change the power settings, you know, to force it to hibernate,
right.
Close the lid, hibernate. Now, it only takes like 10 seconds maybe at most to wake up. which is not that much, but it's annoying. But at least it did its primary function, which it worked as a laptop computer.
Right.
The Nexus 6P that I had did not do its primary function, right, which is to work as a handheld computing device. So I sent that one back, and I gambled that they would come up with the driver fix for this one that fixed it, and they seem to have done that.
I did too. I was waiting. If they hadn't shipped it, they said they were going to ship it on the 16th. They ended up shipping on the 18th. But if they hadn't shipped it by now, I probably would be turning that laptop back in. But now it's one of my favorite laptops. It's really fancy.
It's a very nice machine.
Fantastic to play with.
The sort of ironic thing about Ed's point, Microsoft certainly makes a lot of money off enterprise, and you would have been better off investing in Microsoft as of a couple of years ago than Apple, for example, basically in part because they remembered that's how they make money.
Right.
And frankly,
because they were seduced by the gadget side too.
Among the many mistakes made with the Windows Phone, I think by far the biggest was the fact that it wasn't focused on the enterprise from day one. In fact, the Windows Phone was
totally
significantly inferior, yes, to the iPhone when it came to enterprise features for many years.
It was inferior to Windows Mobile in enterprise features. I mean,
Windows Mobile was enterprise first, right?
Right.
Because they were the only ones buying iPhones at the time, and then they kind of rebooted and they swung all the way to the other side. I think in many respects, there's lots of ways to talk about, you know, what Satya Nadella has done at Microsoft, and I've been a big fan. But I think maybe the if you want to really bring it down to a nutshell, it's kind of remembering what Microsoft is good at and refocusing the company on that. And the way that has played out, you know, focus on Azure and a focus on the cloud generally is the tactics of that, but at a high level position, I think it's been a real narrowing of Microsoft's ambition, and that's can be a really good thing. I mean, focus is something that matters, and kudos to him for that.
You got to say though that Mark Rylance in Bridge of Spies was pretty amazing. I don't know if he's going to win, but I really loved his performance in that. I'm sorry. What were you talking about? Enterprise? I got distracted. But don't you agree? I'm sorry.
I was waiting for you to call me about the Windows Phone thing, and I was going to feign being asleep. So I have sympathy for the joke, and I'm glad I didn't do it. Because
no, I don't mind. Sure. I'll take the heat. So Hollywood Presbyterian Hospital. Wow. Sad story here. This is been down. Their computer systems were down for more than a week. They were hit by ransomware. I don't think it was targeted at the hospital. I don't think this was a spear phishing attack. I think it was just a net. They got caught in a net, and unfortunately, they didn't have email. They didn't have access to patient data. They were admitting patients on paper with pens. They were using horrors, fax machines, and telephones to get work done. Finally, they gave up and they paid the ransom, which turned out to be 40 bitcoins. That's all.
$17,000, right?
Yeah. $17,000.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's all. But you know what? Had I been there, I would have counseled them not to, because so many times we've heard of people paying the ransom and not getting the key.
Right.
Or getting a key that didn't work, but apparently it did.
Well, for $17,000, it doesn't
worth
hurt.
A try.
And then you at least know.
Yeah. You're screwed.
You know, because your IT staff will burn through that in about 30 minutes.
Right.
When you're trying to recover from this. But there's, you know, we're back to the enterprise again, and now all of a sudden you've got an interesting enterprise story, don't you? Because
why are you running a hospital that's vulnerable to this? Is question number one.
There were some pretty big mistakes being made.
Yeah. Yeah. If your X-ray machine is on the public internet, you're not doing it right.
No, I mean. I seriously hope that every person on that IT team, like, that every job is, like, vetted, and that, I mean, honestly, like, I don't want anybody to lose their jobs, but at the same time, it doesn't sound like these people were doing them that well.
Right.
Like, what are you doing?
Right.
How is this?
It's not hard, I don't think. It's not hard to put a fairly nice little, we have it here, a little security appliance in between you and the outside world that stops things like ransomware from infiltrating.
Well, or that mitigates their damages.
Well, a good backup would have mitigated the damage, right?
A properly architected backup system that takes into account the existence of ransomware in the world. And a network infrastructure that doesn't allow ransomware to spread from PC to PC would help also.
They had none of that.
Apparently not.
Now, on the other hand, Linux Mint. Now, there's a guy.
Yeah.
There's an operating system that's got to be, you know, these guys know. So apparently, I didn't realize this, but the Linux Mint website runs on WordPress. Problem number one. With self-hosted WordPress, you got to keep on those patches. They must have missed a patch because a bad guy on the 20th got in to the Mint website and repointed the downloads to their own server in Bulgaria, where they were offering a nicely modified ISO of Linux Mint that had a nice backdoor Trojan in there. The good news is because they encourage you, and I use Linux Mint and I love it, because they encourage you to run against the MD5 to validate the ISO, it was noticed pretty quickly. I doubt for it. They think not many people downloaded it.
Two full days. In fact, they discovered it on day one, and they made the announcement, okay, we've fixed this now, and everything's fine. And several people in the comments section said, no, you didn't fix it.
No, it's actually not fixed, dude.
Yeah.
And then
we're still down. And so then they took the website completely offline.
Yeah.
But this is... Can I do a shruggy here?
Tsunami botnet malware was loaded into the disk image. So if you downloaded Linux Mint, you have to be set version 17.3, the Cinnamon edition. That's the desktop that it was on.
On the 20th or the 21st.
On the 20th or the 21st. That's
until just earlier
recently,
today. Like 12 hours ago.
Yeah. Don't use it.
The other thing too is, I mean, it's just like the Presbyterian Hospital thing. I mean, it's become a cliche to blame WordPress, but one, I'd like to know how up to date, as you know, the WordPress installation was, and two, what plugins they had installed and whether they were embedded. Because that's actually the vast majority is out of date plugins are for most WordPress exploits. But then three, I mean, what was their web server architecture that getting them access to all this other stuff?
Yeah, I would say it probably wasn't WordPress. I think that unless they were running a really out-of-date version, because that's had automatic updates for a while and has gotten a lot better, it probably was something on their server side where they were then
It probably was a WordPress plugin is what I would bet. But the whole point is that should be isolated from where you're hosting all this other stuff anyway. I mean, it's...
Right. Well, that's
it
what
shouldn't
I mean.
Be that easy to change the link to the download.
And this is why this is why the year of desktop Linux is still
it's not fair or it's incorrect to be cavalier about security and say the government will keep the secure key safe or this forensic tool will not be leaked. I mean, it's a reminder. I mean, all this stuff is related. Like their security is incredibly challenging on the internet, and it's why encryption matters and why encryption is important. And all these stories are in many respects related.
And the FBI did an interesting thing. Of course, they were trying to capture child pornographers. They seized the Playpen, which was apparently a popular child porn site on the dark web, and kept it running. That's a little suspect right there. In order to catch more suspects, they used malware to crack the Tor browser that people... It was on the dark web, so it was an Onion site. So they were using malware to get into it. On Wednesday, a judge ruled that defense lawyers in the FBI case must be provided with all the code used to hack the client's computers. When asked whether the code would include the exploit used to bypass the security features of the Tor browser, the public defender told Motherboard everything. The declaration from our code expert was quite specific and comprehensive, and the order encompassed everything identified. So we may learn how the FBI pursued this, the malware that they were using. They apparently infected as many as 1,000 computers.
Well, this is the Jonathan Zerzyski argument playing out in real life.
Yeah.
Like, defense lawyers do have a right to this.
Right. They're going to get the code.
Right, exactly.
For all we know, they're going to publish it online.
Well, I mean, they will be under court order. Yeah, they will be under court order, and they to keep it, you know,
they'll be under order.
If that happened, they would be fine in contempt of court. But, I mean, the reality is, I mean,
he might keep it on a USB key that he leaves at the airport by accident. You don't know.
I was just saying, you know, documents under seal and information under seal gets leaked all the time.
Right.
So, I mean, that's kind of the thing.
137 people have been charged. So it was a very successful sting. Computers in Greece, Chile, and the UK. Let's take a break. A couple more stories, and we're going to let you guys go because the Academy Awards are coming up. but you got to say, I mean, Mark, I love Mark Rylance, and I thought he was so good in Bridge of Spies as the spy. Abel. Our show today brought to you by, you're not taking my bait. The show today brought to you by GoToMeeting, the powerfully simple way to meet with coworkers and clients from the convenience of your computer, your smartphone, or your tablet. I love GoToMeeting because it just makes a meeting more interesting. You know, nobody likes meetings. And nowadays, with everybody distributed all over the world, it's harder and harder to have a meeting. And yet meetings are the most effective way to cut through the confusion, to get down to work, to brainstorm. You just got to do it. If you're presenting to a client, you want to meet with them. You want to make the client want to meet with you, too. It can't be a chore for them, and that's why I love GoToMeeting. It's easy for you, but it's easy for them also. You can go to GoToMeeting right now and try it free for 30 days. You'll be up and running in minutes, literally before the show's over, certainly before the Academy Awards start. And I know I'm confusing the hell out of people by saying that. And your clients, it's the same thing. You just send them a link in the email. They click the link. If they don't have the software, it downloads. Seconds later, they're in the meeting. You know what? They're going to be pretty impressed because now they're seeing your screen, and more than that, they're seeing you with that HD quality picture. It's like you're in the same room. Share screens to present, to review, get feedback in real time. I've used it to collaborate. It's so real time. I was able to rehearse a speech that I was giving with other presenters in real time on GoToMeeting. It was awesome with my slides and everything. GoToMeeting. Try it free right now. All you have to do is go to the website, gotomeeting.com. There's a big fat old orange try it free button. You click that button. You'll be meeting in minutes. Don't take my word for it. Try it. Go to meeting.com. Big victory for the Electronic Frontier Foundation on late Friday. This is relatively breaking news. They were challenging the NSA's internet and telephone surveillance. The case was Juul versus the NSA. The EFF was authorized on behalf of the plaintiffs to conduct discovery against the NSA. They've been trying to do this since the case was filed in 2008. For 8 years, the government's been blocking them. For the first time ever, the EFF now will have access to what the NSA is up to, what tools they are using. This is huge. The government was unable to prevail in court. So the door is open for discovery, and I'm very interested what the EFF finds out. The EFF is suing the NSA and other government agencies on behalf of AT&T customers. This is exactly what you were talking about earlier, Ben. The secret room in the San Francisco AT&T headquarters, which were controlled by the NSA, which we learned about because of whistleblowers like you. So please come forward and tell us what you know. You probably don't like this story so much, Ed, the Verge story, how schools around the country are turning dead Microsoft PCs into speedy Chromebooks. Although this is a good use of a dead Windows machine.
Yeah. It's
These are 8 to 10 year old Dell desktops and laptops. I mean, these are not, what are you going to do with these?
So, you can run Windows 7 on it, but yeah, no, you're making a great point.
Yeah, no, I think a Chromebook is a better idea. And you know what's good about Chromebooks? You can't run Minecraft on them. And that's what you need in a middle school and high school, right?
It's true. You don't want the kids playing games all day.
Yeah. Did you read?
But they just have their phones anyway. So, I mean, I really don't.
I know, you're screwed.
So they have their phones anyway. So they're playing Minecraft Mobile, so Pocket Edition. So, I mean, they're not paying, and they're texting. So they're not paying attention.
Damn
anyway.
Those kids. Like, really. Damn them. I love John Markoff's article last Sunday in the New York Times. We didn't speak about it on the show last week, but I encourage you to check it out. He's talking about how IBM came up with a good voice for Watson, the computer that played Jeopardy, and of course now is doing all sorts of things. In fact, you've seen the ads of Watson talking to people from everybody from Bob Dylan to athletes. And he has clips. I guess Markoff has written a book about computer speech synthesis, which I think would be a fascinating read. But let me play some of these samples, because you probably heard Watson. These are examples that they use.
This island that was home to
Jeopardy.
A notorious prison.
This is the voice they ended up using
on TV. Golden Gate National Recreation Area in San Francisco.
Here comes Watson.
What is Alcatraz?
Right.
A national site for 2000.
That's a human.
This state's only national
That's
memorial
Trebek.
Honors clergymen. Roger Williams. Jennifer.
What is Rhode Island?
That's it.
Jennifer? Yeah. Really?
A little deep.
What is Rhode Island? This is the fun one. IBM researchers exploited voices that had various levels of expressiveness and intonation. This was designed to sound childlike, but was rejected.
This island.
When evaluators said it sounded creepy.
Is part of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area in San Francisco.
What is Alcatraz?
Right. This state's only national memorial.
I can't believe they even considered.
Roger Williams. Jennifer.
What is Rhode Island?
That's it.
Yes.
Go 400.
I'm here to kill you.
anyway, a great article. Highly recommended. And Markoff does a great job. I can't wait to read the book. Just looking at the bottom of the, you know, the stuff that sank to the bottom of the list. Anything else we want to talk about? I think that's it. Are you doing something special for the Oscars, Christina, next week?
Well, my husband's birthday is on Saturday.
Damn.
And
his mom
is coming into town. Oh, so I'm not sure. We might be having some sort of, I might be doing like going to a bar or something for Oscar night. I don't know, but I might end up being with the family because,
you tweet it though. You will be tweeting.
Of course.
Please.
Obviously.
I beg of you.
Come on. I've been live blogging the Oscars so long. I mean, I think you could go back more than a decade and like find my old live journal from like high school and see stuff.
Wow.
I mean, it's yeah.
The Oscars obviously are what Twitter was made for.
It really is.
In my opinion. We're good. We'll look forward to that. And of course, all your writing at Mashable.com.
Thanks so much.
It's always a pleasure. You could follow her on the Twitter if you want to follow those Oscar tweets at @film_girl.
Yes.
Mr. Ben Thompson from Stratechery. He offers every week a free article, and this week it was, of course, the article about the Apple FBI or DOJ story.
I actually wrote about Zenefits, which we didn't talk about.
Oh, man, what a story there, huh?
Yeah, that was a huge story.
What the hell? So Zenefits was a high flyer, 3 years old, right? Not very old. The idea, in fact, we even considered using them. The idea is you replace your old benefit system, which you might be doing, your old HR system, payroll, with this fancy, super-duper automatic software, great dashboard, easy to use, saves you money. It seemed like a modern way to handle HR. Turns out, maybe not so modern. A lot of it was done by humans who made a lot of mistakes behind the scenes. They had an extremely aggressive sales force. And one of the things they were doing, of course, in order to sell, the software, this medical insurance software, you had to be certified by the state, and there was a fairly, 52-hour course you had to take. So, hey, that, no problem. They wrote software that would let the computer think you were watching while you were sleeping. I think they got in a little bit of trouble for that.
Did anyone call it Zenron?
They're not out of business. They fired the CEO. They brought in a new CEO who was pledged to fix everything. They got rid of the sales guy that was maybe overly aggressive. What is your take on this, Ben?
Well, I mean, they brought in a new CEO who was the COO who mysteriously didn't know anything that was going on.
I knew nothing. I know nothing.
I mean, they're also, you know, they've fallen very short of their revenue projections. Oh. So there was clearly a lot of pressure going on. I think what I wrote about in the angle was, and we was. there was sort of a lot of think pieces that came out along the lines of, you know, Silicon Valley needs to get its act together, the bad boy routine, et cetera, et cetera. And they were comparing Zenefits to Uber. And my contention was that this current Zenefits situation was very different than the Uber one. And so the point of the article was kind of exploring why, like when does it make sense to challenge regulation? When does it not make sense? And in this case, the regulation was unambiguous. No one was benefiting from challenging it other than Zenefits. There's no consumer benefit. There was no recourse. Uber gets people to protest and to write to their elected officials and things like that.
They were banned in Utah.
Right. That was the angle I took, was I think the Zenefits Utah case was much more like Uber, and there it made sense to challenge it. Whereas this was just pure cutting corners. And while there was a benefit, you could argue it wasn't worth the risk. It was just poor business judgment.
Yeah.
And so that was the point. That was the point of my piece. I do have a daily update, which is subscribers only, but I had one about Apple that I made free, which I again had to update.
And this one's from Monday. Zenefits article is also free.
Yeah. So I mean, they're both there.
I subscribe, so I can't tell what's free or not because I love it. And you should all subscribe. It's well worth it. Keeps Ben in fried rice and Guy Bao and his family.
yep. And then Exponent FM is my own podcast.
Oh yeah, tell me again.
Exponent.fm.
Exponent.fm. Yep. Must listen to. Yeah.
It's all work.
Yeah. Really appreciate all the work you do, and I'm so glad we can get you on here when we can. Thank you, Ben. Appreciate it. Thank you also to Ed Bott, who writes for ZDNet on a regular basis. Thank you for your takedown of that. And I have to say, I kind of was one of the people suckered by Cheese's crust. But as you say, Mr. Crust made some fundamental errors in what he was assuming was Windows 10 phoning home. It wasn't phoning home. It was phoning a Teredo server, for crying out loud.
Yeah. Oh, that was such a...
I fell for it.
There's a word for that.
Jesus crust.
Jesus crust. Well, he did. So
by the way, he disappeared, didn't he? He said, I'm sorry.
He deleted his account.
He's like, I don't know anything.
But, you know, to me, the issue was this was a story that was on Forbes.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. 400,000 people read this story, and it was crap. It was fact-free. It was fact-free crap. And then there was a follow-up story that was even worse. And so it was, and despite the author of that story thinking that I personally took delight in insulting him, I didn't. And in fact, I went out of my way to focus on the facts in this story. There's just so much FUD. And I will have a follow-up story coming this week on what actually is in Windows telemetry. And
oh, I would love to know that, actually.
You'll be shocked to learn how little there is there.
If you turn off all the phone home stuff. Because, I mean, if you're using Cortana...
One switch.
Cortana needs to communicate with the server. You're asking it to collect information about you. But if you... So you flip one switch and it shuts down.
Well, they're two different things. Telemetry data is the diagnostics data that Microsoft is using for its data-driven design
the user experience or whatever they call that. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. DiagTrack is the name of the service.
That's how they know, for instance, that nobody used Windows Media Center, and the few people who launched it went, "What's this?" and closed it right away.
25% of 6%, I believe, was the figure there. But that's how they know that systems are crashing because of a defective video driver or power supply or something, and they can fix it in a matter of days instead of waiting for the support lines to light up. So on balance, it's a good thing.
So I got the headline for you. I turned off Windows telemetry, and you'll be shocked at what happened next.
Thanks. I'm using that.
Just little tip, something I learned from BuzzFeed. Yep. Thank you, Ed. It's great to have you. Thank you, Christina. Thank you to our great friend, Ben. It's good to have all three of you on a day where we had some really good stuff to talk about, and you did not fail. We thank you all for watching. I know it was a long show today, maybe one of the longest shows we've ever done. I appreciate your patience. I hope you got something out of it. We do the show every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time. That's 2300 UTC if you're watching elsewhere in the world. Of course, you don't have to watch live. You don't even have to watch the whole thing. Just subscribe. You can download it. You can listen to it over a period of days or weeks. In fact, it may even be that the Academy Awards are starting in just a few minutes if you're listening to this now. It could really be the case. But normally they'll be on the 28th. Just that's the normal time.
Say goodnight, Leo.
I got to say goodnight. It's time. We thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time. Another twit is in the can. Bye-bye.